It made sense to me to call off the afternoon's meeting. I rang Floyd Chivambu, hilarious, hilarious conversation, right? Obviously, one was hearing a lot of things yesterday afternoon, but I hadn't known that Mr. Moyane had been suspended. So I ring Floyd. You know, I engaged with you, Mr. Lees, about getting permission for a three-line work. So then he tells me, but, you know, can we call somebody who's been suspended? So I said, no, that matter is still being discussed. And then he tells me, well, look at your news. And then I check. So Floyd let me know, rather than my own party. But I knew things were brewing, but I had no idea it would happen immediately then. But there we are. The commissioner's gone. I think he's suspended, but he's not in his... Now, obviously, I have the same cell number as I did... Oh, welcome to Peggy Nkonyeni. She's our very new member. I'm told Nathan Schleck has been deployed to this committee. And we also have somebody who's new. She's finding her feet, as it were, in Parliament and visiting various committees to decide or have some say in where she gets deployed. She's in the DA. It's Ms. Ngweni, I said, right? Gwen is the first name. All right. Welcome. I'll have to behave today, Gwen. Otherwise, we'll frighten you, and you will leave this committee even before you joined it. All right. So basically, and I gather Mr. Mania is, wife is having a baby. Is that correct? Today or tomorrow?
It was born about an hour ago.
So all right. So we should send him a letter of good wishes and to his wife. Move on to tell you that Dickie Lady is on leave this morning. She said she'll come in the afternoon. Her sister is not well. I've already wished her well on our behalf. Now, I have the same cell number as I did in May 1995. So even the peasants in Mongolia WhatsApp me about their tax issues, right? So this morning from 5:30, I got SMSs and WhatsApps. And I said, look, on the matter of Mr. Tom Moyane, I said, look, there's a committee meeting today. There are already precedents in the way the committee's managed things for me to speak, but it's better we do a collective statement. Now, unfortunately, I was dictating a letter. My PA is not around with somebody else. And, you know, I haven't quite finished it, but there's nothing phenomenally new to say, and I wanted some consent for a statement, which, you know, if you agree to, then I can actually like draft. It's not a big deal, a short statement. In the first instance, let me inform you that Mr. Kingon, Mark Kingon, we know he's been around, he doesn't speak much at meetings. So all of us, I think, we've been here since July 24, know him, know of him. Now, he's been appointed acting commissioner, is that right, Momo? And he phoned me early this morning to say that he will cooperate fully with the committee. He would like to meet with us as soon as possible. He wanted to know from me already this morning, what is it that the committee wants us to focus on? And he asked whether the meeting is going ahead today. But between Alan and me, late last night, early hours this morning, we felt it would not be fair to call the new commissioner here this afternoon. But the issues that we are dealing with, we cannot escape from. The Makwakwa matter, the KPMG report, and so on, and STARS, if there's any issue, though I think they're not going to give us a little answer, I must alert the DA, on Steinhoff, whether Steinhoff isn't paying all his taxes and so on. So those issues remain. So, colleagues, I'd like to suggest that we defer that till the first 2 weeks after we come back, because we also want to have hearings on the VAT bill and so on. It just doesn't seem practicable to call, as Floyd said to me, not knowing I hadn't known by then, that how can you call a suspended commissioner? And I said, oh, of course, right, fine. So I take it the decision I took on behalf of us was, it's not a controversial decision, it's a practical decision, because people are flying in this morning. And they're mostly state functionaries. No, they're all state functionaries. And it just seemed that Alan should let them know last night. So, in fact, we've already informed them. So I take it retrospectively, it was a reasonable thing to do. So any comment on that? That we postpone it. Right. Then the next thing is we have to issue a statement, and just bear with me, right? I dictated something and it's just now been sent to me. But look, can't it be along these lines, right? I have typed some of it, but I can read that. But if I give me 1 second, I can read maybe as much of it as possible. But they are all scattered points. And then I'll string it together. It's not going to take too long. So let me just do this quickly. I'm not very fast, unlike Floyd and others. Floyd's one-third my age, right? So he has to be a bit empathetic, if not sympathetic, right? Right, good. I thought it was older, right. So at a meeting of the Standing Committee on Finance this morning, the following statement was agreed to. We can tweak it, you know, but if you give some latitude, because I'll do it, you know. We welcome the President's decision to suspend SARS Commissioner Mr. Tom Moyane and urge that the disciplinary inquiry into his conduct be fair, swift, and decisive. In our joint fiscal framework report adopted by Parliament on 7th March, our committee and the Select Committee on Finance recommended as follows. This is now the report we adopted on the 7th of March, and I'm literally quoting from it. Those of you have forgotten, here it is. We urge the President to establish the Commission on SARS as soon as possible. Part of its mandate should include an investigation into how SARS has managed the allegations against Mr. Jonas Makwakwa and Ms. Kerry Ann Elsky. It should also investigate the legitimacy of SARS disbandment of the high-risk investigation unit, the so-called rogue intelligence unit, including through considering the significance of KPMG's withdrawal of its recommendations on this unit. While we fully support representativity in the senior management and SARS more generally, and have been constantly focusing on the need for this, we think the Commission should also look into the exodus of senior staff in recent years. We wrote to the Minister and the President in this regard last week, asking them to consider our request. Now, then we can go on to say something about, you know, that we understand that tax revenues have gone down because of the slowdown in economic growth. But we also think the reason for the failure to achieve targets is also attributable to the lack of unity, cohesion, efficiency, and effectiveness within SARS, right? And something like, let's say, we have repeatedly raised this matter with SARS at every quarterly meeting, but it has fallen on deaf ears. Something then that goes on to say that we need to learn the lessons from the past few years of SARS conduct so that we look into what policy, regulatory, and legislative amendments are necessary. In this regard, the committee repeats its call on the executive to consider establishing a board to which SARS is accountable. And then go on to say, while supporting this proposal and recognizing that the President appoints the SARS Commissioner, after consultation with the Minister of Finance, the SARS Commissioner should also be accountable to the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Finance has to ensure that he or she does not unduly interfere politically in the internal matters of SARS. Then we must note that the Acting Commissioner, Mr. Mark Kingon, rang the committee chair this morning and expressed his commitment to cooperating with the committee within the law and rules of Parliament, and then say that amongst the issues we think he and his colleagues at SARS should focus on is ensuring that SARS officials are above reproach, that the focus should be on illicit financial flows. There are staggering amounts of money leaving this country. SARS must work with other agencies in ensuring that it stems the flow of this money out of the country. Something like, what else? That we feel that everybody, whoever they are, must pay the taxes that are owed to the people of South Africa. What else? Colleagues, can you add? I've got some bullet points here, that I thought about. I don't know. Oh, yes, and VAT returns are processed in terms of clear, open, and transparent policies. That's what we've raised many colleagues. I'm not saying anything particularly new. In fact, to be quite frank, if you look at our reports and our discussions, all I'm doing is summarizing what we have been saying, right, over the last, I think, 3 years. So we don't want a long statement. Nobody's going to, you know, like, bother to read a long statement. More or less along those lines. Okay. Floyd had his hand up, then Mr. Lees.
No, thanks, Chair. I think we should more specifically highlight the issue of establishment of a board that is going to oversee the revenue collector. And that legislation should be expedited if there is about changes in that regard. That is one. But two, we should find an accountability mechanism of SARS to the Standing Committee on Finance, because in many instances, the suspended commissioner would cite the confidentiality clause in the Tax Administration Act to avoid being accountable on certain instances. There has to be a mechanism of holding SARS accountable in terms of certain tax issues, because for instance, is a prima facie issue which should have been clarified on, of SARS giving a VAT return of close to 80 million rand to a criminal syndicate that did not have any bank account. And when we raise that, they say, no, we cannot disclose SARS and the taxpayers' information, which is inappropriate. There are lots of instances where wrong settlements are made and everything else, and we do not have oversight responsibility over that, because of that confidentiality issue. I think we must then come with a mechanism of how do we handle it. If it means that we have some of those accountability sessions in camera, we might have to consider that. But ultimately, we should hold the revenue collector fully accountable on each and every aspect, because they collect tax in secret and come and make commitments here. When they've not met them, they blame everyone else except themselves. So there has to be a different modus operandi moving forward. I think we must learn from the mistakes that were made under the misguidance of Tom Moyane, and then we would then consolidate on the leakages and we'll see how we move forward. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that you've covered it very well, and one doesn't want to make it a shopping list, but may I request that we have a focus on the Davis Tax Committee's recommendations. Is it in your notes? So in particular, the establishment of the advisory board and the procedures to be adopted with the appointment and removal of the SARS Commission. I think those are two key ones would fit in with this particular statement.
Things to be considered. Anyway, Davis, yeah, I dictated something about expediting the Davis Tax Commission. Look, we're not having a discussion on it. We're here on other urgent matters, right? I'm sorry, but we will give the full time allocated to this, right? Okay. There is one other matter that I have to do, right? So, yes, actually, you know, to be fair, Floyd, that issue has preoccupied us. We've asked Advocate Jenkins to look. He has done the work, eh? He gave us a three-pager. Last 2 weeks ago, it came up again. We haven't done the work. We had a recommendation that this be done and that we get the minister to look at it. Now, basically, what we had suggested, Floyd, because you're a chief whip and you serve in thousands of committees, you may not know what goes on here, but we've taken this much further. We're saying, look, we should avoid people also politically smearing each other, right? So, for example, if you and I are standing for president of the country, you're going to claim that I'm not paying my tax and I'm going to claim. So you should have a right to appear before a closed committee meeting. We're asking for all of that. So we have to have greater accountability while ensuring that state institutions are not used to settle political fights or fights within the business sector. So that we're on the same page on. I think we just need to repeat our call in that regard. That Parliament has to do the work, Floyd. And maybe we should again push Advocate Jenkins over the constituency period to come with proposals. But it was repeated only 2 weeks ago, if I'm correct, that we haven't delivered on our side. So that is agreed to. That's also something, and the other two issues also we've discussed. So can we just, like, allow me to tweak it, and then we will send it out via the Justice. Justice Molafo has also been contacted. There is something else I will read, and I will distribute to committee members because of what happened last week. I was going to read this stuff, but it's very important, colleagues, because what happened last week was, frankly, in terms of Parliament's rules, not acceptable. And as a chair, I said I will consult, and so I'm going to read this thing. You'll have to bear with me. Colleagues who have come here for Capitec and VBS, you'll have your full time. Don't you worry. So let me quickly go through this. We will not discuss it, if you like, but we owe it to the DA in particular to read this statement. It's dated, okay, 28. It says, there were issues that arose at last Tuesday's sitting on this matter that need to be addressed. Of SARS, KPMG report, Standing Committee on Finance, and the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. Those are the matters. They relate to the rights of MPs to make inputs based on leaked reports in the media, the discussion of intelligence issues by our committee that are being considered by the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, and majority decision-making in a committee on whether the issues an MP raises are constitutional or legal or not. I have conferred with the Chief Whip of the Majority Party and also the the House Chair, Mr. Frolic. Chief Whip told me to tell you that he agrees with every word in the statement. Cedric Frolic said, look, if you want, we will send a National Assembly table person to come and observe the meeting and advise. But both of them agree what happened last week was not acceptable. I said at the end of the meeting that I would confer with Parliament's Legal Services Unit, the Speaker's Office, and others on what is appropriate way to proceed, and I have. Three. I have also engaged with individual MPs in our committee and gathered that there seems to be a misunderstanding on what was being said and or meant. Four, the ANC study group has also discussed the issues, and this input is mainly based on that. Five, I provide here a brief overview of the most relevant issues. Six, Zakhele Shlope has sent all committee members the KPMG reports that are in the public domain, so all members are aware of what is in these reports. Seven, no committee member is compelled to read these reports. It is just for information. Eight, because KPMG 1 has withdrawn its recommendations on the unit in its report. Two, the SARS commissioner rejected this in the public domain through a media conference. Three, the SARS commissioner wrote to the committee to complain about KPMG's conduct. Four, IRBA is now investigating the auditor's behavior in respect of the audit matters of the KPMG report. And five, SAICA is carrying out a public inquiry into this matter, the Chartered Accountants. Therefore, there are aspects of the report that relate to our committee, in particular, the audit aspects and the way SARS has managed the KPMG report. Then point 9 of the paragraphs overall, it is not for our committee to look into issues related to whether the SARS so-called rogue intelligence unit, the high-risk intelligence unit, was legally mandated to do what work it did and whether it acted outside the law. Those issues belong to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence and any other relevant investigative body. Please see also a letter from the chairperson of that committee, which has been sent to you last night. 10. According to our information, KPMG has confirmed that the leaked reports are earlier drafts it prepared. 11. Following various exchanges, my understanding is as follows. A. Any MP from any party has the right to raise relevant issues to the subject being discussed in a committee and can base these issues on any report she or he has, especially one that is in the public domain. In fact, we all, across political parties, used leaked reports in the Daily Maverick to deal with the Makwakwa matter earlier in last Tuesday's meeting. We did not require that these leaked reports be authenticated. C. We are clear that we cannot suppress anybody from raising questions from some reports, such reports rather, based simply on a decision of the majority of MPs in a committee. The ANC study group is clear that it would also be unacceptable in terms of ANC policies, little on Parliament, and the Parliament and the laws and rules that the ANC has mainly, though not solely, shaped as part of our commitment to a multi-party, open and transparent national democratic Parliament. In any case, no court in the country will agree that a decision based solely on a majority vote of a committee can determine what an MP is raising is unconstitutional or illegal. Moreover, unless the MP raises the issue in the first place, the legal services unit cannot advise the committee on whether the issues raised are legal or procedural or not. Ultimately, it's the chairperson of a committee that will be held accountable for any abuse of majority decision-making in a committee. While a chairperson has latitude to make decisions and guide a committee, she, he cannot express this outside the rules of Parliament or in ways that are not legal. Parliament's legal services unit is responsible to advise the committee on what is legal and assist the chair to make appropriate rulings in this regard. D. However, the ANC wants to make clear that its objections to Mr. Mania's line of questioning is based on the following. One, the KPMG report is not the usual audit report, as Erba also confirms. But the ANC agrees that it is relevant to our committee because of the role of the auditor and SAR's management of issues and for the reasons set out in paragraph 8 above. However, the KPMG report deals mainly with intelligence issues and therefore belongs primarily, though not solely, to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, whose members receive security clearance to process intelligence issues in closed meetings. Our committee members do not have security clearance, and we cannot discuss intelligence issues in an open committee. Two, Mr. Mania was requested by the chairs of SCOF and the JSCI to refer these questions related to intelligence to the JSCI chair through the DA members in the JSCI, but he has refused to do so on the grounds, one, he does not recognize the Standing Committee on Intelligence or its right to meet in closed meetings. If this is the case, presumably this is his personal view, not that of the DA, since the DA participates in that committee, and or he does not recognize the right of the Standing Committee of Intelligence to deal with the intelligence issues in the KPMG report. These issues for Mr. are for Mr. Mania and the DA to address, not our committee. Yes, there is a court case pending on aspects of the alleged irregularities of former members of the so-called Rogue Intelligence Unit, which also limits how far we can pursue this matter further in our committee. Four, it is therefore only in this specific context and on the specific intelligence issues in the leaked report that it is correct to hold that Mr. Mania cannot ask certain questions because, as explained above, the intelligence issues are being addressed by the JSCI and the main draft report in the public domain has to be authenticated by that committee if they use it at all. Presumably, they will process the report as provided to them by SARS. In short, therefore, we cannot, as explained above, have any general objection to MPs raising issues based on leaked reports that are relevant to a matter on the committee's agenda, and Mr. Mania is welcome to deal with the non-intelligence aspects of the leaked report. I'm about to conclude. Parliament's Legal Services Unit will advise in identifying aspects of the leaked report that are relevant to our committee, the non-intelligence aspects. Please see the relevant advice from Advocate Frank Jenkins in this regard. 13. In the processing of aspects of the report that are relevant to our committee, we need to also take into account, one, we cannot preempt the outcomes of the legitimate IRBA investigation into the role of the auditor in the KPMG report. Two, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants is also undertaking an inquiry into the conduct of KPMG in the matter. Three, we will recognize the official IRBA report as the primary report for our purposes. 14, on the basis of the position set out here, we'll continue to deal with the non-intelligence aspects of the KPMG report and the way in which SARS has managed KPMG's withdrawal of most of the recommendations of the report. I propose that the committee matters raise whatever you want within the framework that's provided. Now, why I'm tabling this is because I'm required to do so by the chief whip of the majority party, not the chief of a parliament, chief of a majority party. We don't have a chief whip of parliament, and also the House chair. And they were going to send a representative here to endorse the statement. So it's not about me and my chairing. It's about the rules and the constitution and the legislative role of parliament. We can't do anything about that. Okay. We can't do anything about that. Okay, comrade. Now, the next thing is, because we are not discussing this issue and because it's not fair to you, since you don't have a written version of this, I will distribute it to you. And when we come back to this issue early in the next quarter, you're free to comment on this. But I have to indicate that the DA has every right, as any other party, to raise any question it wants, from any report leaked by anybody in the public domain or anywhere. There is no rule. We only say that you can't deal with the intelligence issues, and we refer you now to your respective members, the DA and other parties, in the Intelligence Committee. So Mr. Mania is free to raise whatever he wants. And there's nothing to discuss with me. I would suggest anybody unhappy with this, go to Mr. Frolic and go to Jackson Mtembu. It's easy for Floyd because he's the chief whip of his party. He can raise it there. So I have to table this. It's like a ruling of a speaker. I'm sorry I had to come to this thing. But we really cannot, because it's been raised repeatedly with me that sometimes I'm giving too latitude to people. I keep indicating I have no power to repress people who are democratically elected in this parliament. So nobody, not me, not anybody in this committee, not the speaker, not the chief of it can override the rules in the constitution. So this is a guide now. So I would like people to look at it carefully, and much of it you'll be interested to know, almost all of it, is in fact endorsed by the ANC study group. And we accept that the way we came across last week may have been misunderstood, and I think we owe it to Mr. Mania to say we regret that he wasn't given the chance to speak, and he has the right to speak. But he, too, must take responsibility. He can't come here and raise intelligence issues, and he can't say he doesn't recognize what he can, that's his right. But that's a matter you must address, Mr. Mlis and Gwen Stunew, with Mr. Steenhuisen and Mr. Maimane and Mr. Mania. That's our issue. So I had to do that. It's not something we need to discuss. Thank you very much. Can we move on now to Capitec and the program we have is as follows. We're going to, colleagues, we have all the regulators and the relevant people here. Alan's been managing with Tebo the program. There is one issue, colleagues. The curator refused to come. And Alan, in despair, kept contacting me yesterday. And Monday is constituency day, and I'm not accessible because you have to switch your phones off in many meetings. So I told him, my friend, what else can you do? It's for the committee to decide. So can you just give a report, and the committee can mull over whether the curator should have been here, and by the end of the meeting, we decide what we have to do. Next week, we'll have to decide about Mr. Yuska. Up till yesterday, he's been engaging with our lawyers. There's no commitment for Mr. Yuska to appear, and the committee has to decide, or the four committees have to decide, what do we do? Do we subpoena and so on? Can you please explain what's going on, Alan? What happened and what are they saying?
Thanks, Jay. Last week, I contacted...
Do we have new members?
Last week, I contacted VBS, the CAO's PA, sent all the relevant notices through to them. Yesterday, I received an email after following up that the curator won't be here. No reasons given. And he's last night, he sent an email just to say that he's met the registrar earlier today, which was yesterday. And he advised me that I don't have to attend this session. I trust that this clarifies, and that was it.
We have a right to know and a right to decide. This is Parliament, right? Fine. We'll hear you, and then we'll decide. I won't decide. We. Okay? I'll merely implement the majority decision. Good?
No, thank you, Chair. I think between the registrar and I, we just want to maybe and the other regulators, let me answer this specific, but I think more generally we wanted to clarify. Firstly, the registrar operates under the direction of the registrar and, the curator operates under the auspices of the registrar and, of course, is appointed by way of a letter from the Minister of Finance. I think, Chair, on all these issues of regulation, I just for the record, I do want to just express a concern that we have. The regulators have all come to say, you know, a lot of these hearings are taking place at a very early stage. And they do feel they've been put under pressure to reveal information which, frankly, will undermine their case in the sense that they are, their regulatory strategy is being put out in a public domain. In many of these instances, like with the curator, the curator really has just started. They don't really know what's happening. We can give you the rationale between the registrar and the treasury, obviously, on why there's a curatorship. The curator's job then is to go and find out the information to the extent that there's reports from the curator, obviously Parliament's free to talk to them, but we prefer that you first do it in the first instance through the Treasury and the SARB. And I think particularly even later when it comes to both the Capitec matter or VVS, and I think there are different issues. Some of these are not regulatory issues. I think the regulators can just say what they normally do. To take the instance of Capitec, Chair, just as an example, here we have what's a report from from Viceroy. No, but there's lots of these analysts report. There are normally hundreds of them for any institution. And I think the issues that we would want to consider at some point is just because an analyst writes, it could be negative, it could be positive. You don't want the precedent, I would imagine, that we have to then respond to every analyst report. A lot of those reports, frankly, are nonsensical. But given that we're here, we'll obviously try and contextualize that. But I think a lot of the regulators have asked me to express just their concerns. It's not a problem. They have no problem coming to Parliament. But I think at the stage at which they called up, and often the information that's been asked, they do feel that it compromises their overall strategy. It's revealed to the other, to those who they are investigating, and it does make their work very difficult, Chair. But let them talk for themselves and just provide that perspective as we go on. So with regard to the curator, Chair, let the registrar just explain. And I must say, in this instance, we were not even contacted. So I would also imagine the curators themselves are new to Parliament. They may not know the procedure. They work for some company, in this case, SNG. And it would help if sometimes some of those are just processed through us, because we could facilitate them coming here to the... Obviously, Parliament has a right to talk to anyone directly. One's not taking away that right. But I'm saying we could help facilitate and explain the context sometimes.
The normal procedure was followed. We gave all the email goes to your parliamentary liaison officer, and we don't need your permission. You can only facilitate. And you will know, to be fair, I've been exchanging with you on the phone from day one on Capitec. And in fact, to be fair, Mr. Shivambu wrote to the governor, right, SMS him or something. The governor rang me immediately, right? And I also rang Kubain, right, the registrar, on these issues, and I explained the processes. That they had written to us, again it was the EFF, but I was also doing the same thing. On VBS, I must say, you were faster than I was. But on Capitec, I had already started the process. So he wrote to me, and then I replied. I said, we've already started the process, we just need to find the right time. We don't want to sort of like make the low-income depositors. I explained, Floyd, you were not here. The low-income depositors will flee if they think, you know, Parliament's looking at this issue and the cameras are focused. Not right. These are our own constituents, really. And we don't want to make the markets jittery. This is an allegation. Those are people are short selling and so on. So Capitec was on the agenda. I also reported to everybody that Capitec asked to meet us. Let me report to the open committee. And we asked a subcommittee of two ANC, one DA, and one EFF to come. And for various reasons, people couldn't come, including the ANC. So I met alone with them. I think Sakele was there. Yeah, I know. But the thing is, Tandy, I'm just letting the public know that I'm answerable to the committee. It's my job, Tandy. You're a former chair, right? And the senior one, you know I have to do my job. I'm doing my job. So actually, this I'm responding to Treasury to say there's been a lot of discussion before we came to this. It's not fair. Remember, you, in the thousands of conversations we have, you could have said to me, you know, there's a problem with the curator. So I don't accept what you say on that matter of process. And we have an excellent committee secretary in Allen. And I always tell people, everybody who accuses Allen is guilty unless proven otherwise. So I'll stand in easy. Right? Okay, over to you, Mr. Registrar.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, on the specific issue of the VBS curator, should I continue, Chair? Chair, on the issue of the VBS curator, the curator is appointed by the Minister of Finance, but is reports to the Registrar of Banks. And so I think I'll be able to answer any question that could come for the curator. I do think it's premature to call the curator at this stage. The bank has been in curatorship for a total of 6 working days. it's been a very intense process, and the curator is having to manage what is a very fragile situation with tens of thousands of depositors or people who have investments in stockpiles, etc., and a very, very precarious situation in the bank. I think I'll be able to answer any questions that the committee has for the curator. At a later stage, I think we're more than willing to engage with the committee, with the curator here. At this stage, Chair, given that it's only been 6 days that the bank has been put into curatorship, I think I'll be able to cover any of the issues that the committee may want to raise.
Then up Tandi.
Chairperson, under no circumstances should any citizen in South Africa advise a person who has been convened by Parliament not to come to Parliament. So the Registrar of Banks must never, ever stop any person that we have convened this meeting. You don't have that power. It's not your space at all. You rather communicate to the chairperson, let the curator come here and then explain that I'm not at the stage to could answer questions. Give me more time. We'll determine that ourselves. What if we wanted to give a mandate in certain issues in certain instances? Don't prevent people from coming to Parliament when I've convened them, because the email that he says that you told him that he must not come. You don't have that power. Parliament has a right to convene any citizen to come to the committee so that we can be able to give guidance. Sometimes it's not about the report. Sometimes it's about getting assurances in terms of adherence to the laws and what is expected. So don't interfere with parliamentary processes, unless if you want to be a member of Parliament.
Over to you, Tan.
Chair, first, let me apologize. I started in another meeting. I started in strategy to replace the Kennedy because she couldn't make it for the meeting. Chair, I don't think the issue that we'll be discussing here is whether the registrar, the curator, should be coming or not coming to the legislature. The issue is, what are the issues that we want to discuss so that the scope is very clear as to what do you want to achieve? And one of the things that when we do this, that we should take into account is that what sector specifically are we dealing with, how it operates, and the type of messages we want to send to market. Because ours will not be an irresponsible approach towards the discussions that can send the market jittery in the content of what we want to table before. And the fact also is, when we're dealing with, because the issue here, Momo and Kuben, basically we have a specific focus of institutions that as and when they wish, they themselves send the market jittery. You see, the approach will be totally different as to those institutions that at any given point can say the liquidity of this specific CFI is questionable and how we're going to deal with that moving forward. So here we'll be trying to devise an approach that will have market stability and ensure that there, at any given point, the South African market is not fiddled with by institutions who, as they see competition, might want to get into that space. So it's going to be the scope, it's going to be the content, and you'll understand how legislatures feel about issues of accountability and engagement in the public discourse, so that the lines are not blurred. And let's not belabor the point as to the information dissemination. There's a specific issue that we need to nip in the bud. One of them is this analysis that comes from everywhere at any given time, and deal with our thinking. So basically that should be in that context and we understand it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I do wish to just express a bit of concern about the modus operandi. Whilst I accept that the curator has been in the job for no time at all, really, and perhaps we should have been in a position to consider an approach to delay his or her can't remember now appearance here in Parliament. It should have been that kind of dialogue rather than simply saying you don't have to go. So I think that's clear. I don't think there's an issue there. The issue really then remains: that is Kuben going to be representing or BBS here today? or the Reserve Bank. You know, they're two hats here, and so I'm not sure that the curator would have been able to represent VBS here today, given the short period that they've been in the job. And that's another issue, and I concede that that could be a matter of discussion. So, Kubin, I trust that you'll put your VBS hat on then in due course and give us the answers we need about VBS, as opposed to your oversight role as the bank registrar. So, thank you very much, Chairman.
I think we're all saying the same thing, right? So can we just summarize, right, so that we're clear? One is that, Momo, we understand, they are regulators, we're not supplanting it. For those of you who don't know, and I don't think Floyd does, because he hasn't been able to come, and how much of the mail he gets, he reads, I'm not sure, because he gets from many committees, so it's no, like, criticism. But what we have done now, over the sign-off matter, where people literally almost wanted to convert it into a commission of inquiry, which is then requiring somebody of Venara's stature to be there, we have referred the matter to Speaker's office. It's with them. There's a senior counsel now being appointed, because Advocate Jenkins does the opinion, and some people question his credibility, right? So we said, okay, it's costing a lot of money, I shouldn't tell that reason. Because people in Capitec wanted to, like, cross-examine, and I've explained what the legal implications are, but nobody wants to listen. So, hey, you know what? I've got a lie. So let the Speaker decide on the Rules Committee. It's an opinion that's going to, Mama will calm you down. It's an opinion that's being using the sign-off matter. It's going to actually decide a legal opinion that Parliament's Rules Committee would have looked at. What does a committee do in respect of the private sector, which must be held vigorously and rigorously to account, but where you already have regulatory bodies that you yourself in the post-1994 dispensation established with progressive people there. But you see, Momo, as we said on a Steinhoff issue, this committee is not convinced, notwithstanding all the complexities, that the regulatory bodies are performing as effectively as they should. And as Floyd said earlier, this committee is quite befuddled with the constant argument that there are legal things we cannot say and so on. Then we need to look at the law. The law doesn't allow for the transparency required in the current epoch of rampant corruption. So that era has changed now. That era where, you know, we thought things would go according to, well, even Floyd would have agreed then, the National Democratic Revolution. Right? Look where we are today. So, I'm going to summarize. We're dealing with the matter generally. You're right. We have to clarify. We've got a senior counsel opinion. I think it's been approved of. Oh, by the way, Frank has apologized. He's got a family matter. And he was, like, pleading for being excused as if I'm his father. I said, it's your right. You must have a life. By the way, I was with him on Saturday afternoon and on Sunday over the phone. Floyd may not approve, but hey, I'm not a lawyer. And there he is. He's deployed in this committee and elsewhere. Okay, next thing is, look, man, you know, Quinn, you know you did wrong, right? It's simple. You can't take that decision. It's just wrong, and you know it, right? I mean, really. All you could have done was phone me. Good, right. Thirdly, you know, Floyd's right. What is to stop the curator from coming to simply say what Floyd says? Four, we want to communicate to him what we feel. And I think across at least two political parties, whatever VBS has done or not done, if you take our financial sector transformation report seriously, and you, Kubin, of all people, and the governor, by the way, said he's very, very keen to come himself with Kubin, and he said he's going overseas and not sure he can make Tuesday, right? So if he's not here, I take it you're apologizing. And he had a long discussion with me about it, right, to be fair. And he was very good in all his balances. I'm sure you'll raise those issues. So let's move on. We are where we are. We would like them to come. You can negotiate with the chair. At times the chair will consult with the committee. At times, what do you do at 11:30 at night, right? So, well, you can talk to Floyd, but, I mean, you know, Mr. Lees goes to bed at 7. At his age, it's understandable. So let's move on, shall we? Good. Do you have to speak? All right, fine.
Chair, I think just to be clear, we've been in the forefront of fighting corruption. So, and no, but I want to also say what's been said, okay, because we also have our own integrity. I think we don't have any issue with Parliament having hearings. We think they're welcome. In fact, we think it plays quite a critical role in bringing things out. I think, though, when issues like this come, like in the normal course, we often have a lot of discussion. Nobody told me about the curator, for example. Not that you need my permission. I'm just saying, normally, and a lot has been happening the last few days, so I've also been busy. I've also got lots of emails and so on. We've been extremely busy solving other problems in government, cleaning up, frankly.
I think you are being taken for unnecessary things. We do not need your permission to call the curator. We can call the curator directly as the committee.
No, I'm not allowing it. Right, Floyd, it's over. You're provoking the meeting. I think what he means is something else, but the way he's presenting it is just, no, Kobe. Right, can we move on now? Wasted enough time. Not wasted. We will deal with those issues later. We're on the same page. We understand, okay? We're not questioning your integrity in particular, or anybody, Kubain or who else spoke. No, that's absolutely not an issue. Right, let's move on. Right, the first input then, we know what we're here for, right? We've discussed this fleetingly. It is basically to get a report. We understand, we invited Viceroy, by the way, and Viceroy said they can't come, and they want to link us up with international teleconference. Can't even do teleconferences in this country. We said it's not doable. We did invite them, so they can be heard. Capitec also said to us, bring them. Right, so here we are. What we're going to do, as you know, to summarize quickly for those of you who don't know, is we want, firstly, to understand what is being done about the allegations. Even if the allegations are related to short selling, they may in and of themselves be still legitimate. And we are concerned about what happened at African Bank, and post-2008, you know, I'm not going to give a long lecture, you know why we're here, right, Tandi, you know why we're here. Now we feel, as Parliament, it will be remiss of us not to at least invite Capitec to give its position, Viceroy to give its position, and the Viceroy reports have been distributed, I think summarized, right? So members have it. So we would rather get Capitec to reply to Viceroy. Somebody can, Zakele can give an overview of Viceroy. We sent it out to people 2 weeks ago and again recently. Then what we want to do is find out progress and what is being done about Capitec, right? Are people investigating the Viceroy report? Where is that? Now, we're not asking you to reveal anything the law doesn't allow you to. That law was passed by this Parliament, right? So don't say we're going to ask you to do something. That is all. The public has a right to feel at ease, particularly deposited in Capitec. Now, on VBS Mutual, it's a slightly different category. It's a black-owned bank, mutual bank. We are concerned, obviously, what is being done to rescue it. We don't want it dissolved or anything, disbanded. At the same time, we recognize that the depositors are black people themselves. And we need to find the right balances. So we want to hear from VBS. We want to hear from Capitec. We're going to treat everybody fairly and equally. And then you will report to us when you think you could give us a fuller report with the curator present and so on. And this year's Parliament, I'm told, Floyd, is that right? Are we ending in May, somebody told? End of May, you all decided last week. This next quarter is ending end of May. Is that correct? That's what the chief whip, I think, told me, right? So I want to alert members, we've got a lot, right? So, and we also have agreed that the committee will decide next week on approaching the minister about what bills we need to prioritize. Because in the second half of this year, every party will be busy with the election campaign. Okay, thanks. Right, shall we move on to Capitec, right?
Do you want Capitec to present? Because I was hoping that what you're doing is, obviously, like you said, Capitec and VBS are a different set of issues,
yeah.
Right? So you'll have Capitec, and then do you want responses from us? Do you want a perspective from us first? I don't know in what order.
Yeah, we gave you an agenda.
Yeah.
So that's the agenda. Now, okay. Is anybody unhappy about the agenda from the committee member side?
Fine.
Okay. Right, what are you unhappy about?
No, I'm not asking. Do you want to respond to
Capitec will speak, then everybody's been on. You're number six, yeah. You want to speak first?
No.
We can switch your circuit around. That's not a big deal.
No, it's fine.
Right. So, Capitec, you've got 20 minutes. Okay, I'm going to mark you with a cell phone of mine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, honorary committee members. It's for us a nice privilege to actually present Capitec. What we've done is just to give a bit of an overview that people understand what Capitec is all about, how did we came about, a bit of history, and then we'll go into a little bit of the unsecured market, and then I'll talk about Viceroy. Just to highlight, myself is the CEO of Capitec Bank, Ferry Faree. Then I've got André Plessis at the back. He's the financial director of Capitec Bank. Both of us started the bank in 2000. And then we've got Nkosana Mashia. He's the director responsible for risk. So that's the Capitec team that's presented. That is what we're going to look at. So I'm going to skip that. If we look at the market opportunities when we started in 2000, why did we start? I think the first priority was banking the unbanked. I remember going into Transkei, and in that particular area, it was only Meat Bank operating in that area, so we saw a big opportunity there. We regarded the banking offer as complex, and we believe we can simplify it and we can make it so that people understand it. And then the unsecured market at that particular stage, we were predominantly 30% per month loans, pin and card. So it was a very young, unstable market, and we believe any market needs a dominant player. Who is Capitec? What is our vision? Our vision is to enable clients to better their financial lives. The first step of that is actually that they really understand their bank statements, they understand their transactions, they understand what is happening. And a very important second part of that is actual financial education. We're spending quite a lot of money on financial education, making certain that people understanding their financial position. If I look at our fundamentals, the simplicity and transparency, I think what is important is we've got one product that is sold to all our people. So if you've got Global One, you've got the full product suite. We have got a very simplistic pricing structure, so no ad valorem fees, no percentage. We've got a fixed fee. And then we treat all clients equal, so there's no differentiation at any level. On income, you don't get a purple card or a silver card. Everyone with us get a gold card, and the product offer pricing is exactly the same. And then very importantly is currently a minimum interest rate of 5.1%, so we encourage people to have a positive attitude towards saving. If you look at our clients, a third of our clients is currently banking for free, where the interest income that they're receiving is more than the bank charges that they're actually paying. That's a very quick summary, just that you understand our history. We started in 2000. I think what is important to note is that you can see the progress that we've made becoming a fully-fledged bank. Where are we now? That is the August figures. We're in a closed period. Our results are coming out on Monday, but I can reveal that we should be reaching 10 million clients by about middle April. What is important, about 4.6 million clients is actually banking with ourselves, so they deposit their salary with ourselves, and then 1.4 million clients is lending from ourselves. That is clients that is on book, so that gives you a bit of a feeling for our client base. If you look at our assets, you can clearly see our asset base. We've got 811 branches. I think what is important is a big portion, over 300 of those branches are operating on a Sunday, and we don't operate normal banking hours. We operate retail hours, so the majority of our branches is operating from 8 in the morning till 6, and even we've got some branches that's open till 10. And the whole purpose there is to be available when the client actually wants to do certain transactions. We've got 13,500 people working for ourselves. Just remember, in 2000, there was basically zero. 89% of those people are black employees. We pride ourselves to actually employ people from the community to service the community. We appoint people with high potential and then developing themselves. And you can see 87% of our people are under the age of 35. So our big focus is actually developing and growing our people that is employed by ourselves. Who are we? I think what is important is we've always been very conservative on our accounting policies. If I look at our capital adequacy, the capital that we've held, we've always said we want to build a bank that is 100 years plus old. So we've always been very conservative in our total approach in everything that we're doing. Even on the credit side, we price for risk. Very few organizations are doing that. And on provisioning, you can see on our arrears, we're covering our arrears with a 220% provisioning. The unsecured market, there's 3 points that I want to highlight in the unsecured market. I think the first point is that the market is still very young. It's only 11 years old. If you take inception as 2007, when the first National Credit Act was promulgated, and if you're sitting with a new market, you'll have your ups and downs in that particular market. I think the other very important thing is that I've seen is that your pricing regulations has made a big impact on the market. Our affordability guidelines, a very big impact on the market. And then credit insurance last year that came in, also a big impact on the market. I still believe there's a lot of opportunity on credit insurance because we are allowing
two ways to calculate credit insurance. The one is on reducing balance. So you buy credit insurance as you're reducing your balance, or on initial capital. By allowing it to be on initial capital, you are getting that people are paying. Let's say he's taken a loan for 100,000 Rand, he's repaid it to 20,000 Rand, he's still paying at 100,000 Rand, and that's allowing people to take higher risk. The other important thing that I want to highlight is we've bought overseas company, Cream Finance, and working through 8 countries, I've really experienced and seen that in South Africa, we're far ahead on regulations in the credit market. We're at least 20 years ahead of what's happening there. It's nothing strange to go to England and you see prices of 300% per month, per year, and no guidelines on affordability. So the one thing I must compliment our regulators is the fact that our credit market is very well regulated. How do we provide credit? I think that's the question everyone is asking is, we use BAS, which is behavior. So we look at the behavior of the client outside, inside, on the credit side, as well as on his banking behavior. So we use all three of those areas. Then we look at his affordability. So we look at his salary, and then we're conservative on allowing his variable income, as well as living expenses. And then source, we look at his employer. You need to look at his employer to be able to understand what risky you are. We all know in certain instances, certain times of the year, mining is extremely risky. Other times, it's very solid. So you need to make adjustments for that. And I think that's the important point that I want to highlight there is that credit granting is centrally controlled. So branch personnel has got no input on the granting that we grant. Everything is done on a central basis. That's an interesting slide. If you look at the market, the unsecured market, who's the players in that market? We've used bureau information on that. And I think the first graph on the left is showing that 80% of unsecured credit is being provided by the banks itself and 20% with other institutions. So 80% of that is well regulated. And then if you look at our market share in that particular slide, the slide on the right, and that's according to the BA 900 that has been provided, Capitec's market share of the unsecured market is 25%. So I think that gives you just a perspective of who are the main players in that particular market. Then the question that everyone asks is, who is Viceroy? We've done a lot of research on it. We can't determine if they're a company. They're not registered as a hedge fund or a fund manager. They just say on their website they are individuals that see the world differently. They started in 2016. They've got three individuals. Fraser Pering is 44 years old. He's a social worker that was dismissed, and two very young people of 23 years old. We've definitely picked up that there's three hedge fund managers behind them, supporting them, feeding them information, and we can see it with the type of questions we've got. They don't disclose any on how they regulate it. And I think that gives you just a perspective if you go and look at Capitec, who regulates us and who's regulating Viceroy. In South Africa, nobody regulates Viceroy. Internationally, it's very unclear on who they are regulated by. And if you go and look at on the left, on Capitec side, you see we've got numerous institutions that we need to report back, and it's on a regular basis coming to investigations on ourselves, making certain that we're 100% compliant. Who is Viceroy attacking? What we've determined is there's basically 7 companies internationally that they've attacked in the last in the last 2 years. They use Steinhoff because they got a lot of credibility. Unfortunately, they have brought out their report 3 days after the auditors didn't want to sign off the financial results and when Marcus Huster resigned. So nobody really knows how good their report is, yes or no, but they got a lot of credibility. We know that they've attacked us. And then I've just highlighted a tweet where they're saying that they are investigating other mining, pharmaceutical and healthcare companies. So we believe it's not only Capitec, they're going to actually come in for other South African companies, and that's what they've openly stated. We've investigated how Viceroy operates, and I've just highlighted their modus operandi. To date, it's 100% in line. What we're also experiencing is they're looking for companies with a very high price-to-earning ratio. They short the company. They openly admit that they make profit out of it. They deal with the media. They've written, just to give you an indication, we've answered 4 or 5 of their reports openly in the media and on Sense. We then stated clearly to them that we won't continue having this debate on media. We've actually, in the last report where they actually wrote to our directors, to our board, we've answered them directly back and not back in the media. So they're playing the media game, and what is for us, we've from day one asked them to engage with ourselves telephonically, or we can go and visit them in America. To date, nobody has actually contacted us, so they're working on perceptions or their way of they interpreting our financial results. I've got no problem if they actually talk to ourselves and then go and publish something. But I think it's a critical part of their work should be actually just to talk to ourselves, because we've seen in their work a lot of ratios, a lot of assumptions that was completely incorrect. Other one that we are seeing is in the market is they're talking to ex-employees, they're talking to current employees, they're talking to our clients, they're talking to suppliers. Some of our employees has been contacted and have been offered 5,000 rand per hour. On financial research, but then the second and the third question goes about Capitec. So that's the way they engage. And you can see in all the reports that they actually sent through to us, they are insisting on that there should be an independent investigation being performed. So if I look at the modus operandi, we've analyzed 7 companies, we've researched it, and we're seeing exactly the same modus operandi. We here's the Viceroy allegations. We've tried to summarize it. If you go and look at their first report, it was 34 pages long. We've answered those reports in detail. Unfortunately, it's not easy to answer those questions because you need to go financially through all the answers. They've brought out 3 further reports. All of them we've answered. I'm just going to highlight certain of those areas. They're saying is that we are rolling loans by consolidating us. Only 20% of our capital advance that we're lending out is consolidated, and that is where a person will take a loan, and then let's say 3 or 4 years later, he comes in, he would like to have another loan, then we'll consolidate his first loan. In each and every of those cases, we're doing a full credit bureau search on that client. We're doing a full BAS. We're doing a full affordability to make certain that this is compliant. They said that rescheduling loans are included in our capital advance. We've showed to them that it's not the case. They've also said we're asking additional initiation fee and monthly fees. We've clearly stated to them that is not the case. For members, just to understand rescheduling, I think a very easy example of that is the mining strike 3 years back. Those people were for 3 months basically without income. You've built up a relationship with those clients. What do? You can hand those clients over. Or you actually say to that client, you haven't got income for a 3-month period, so we give you a break for a 3-month period, and then the moment you've got income again, we will you can repay us. Then they've shown that our provisioning is insufficient, but they're comparing apples with pears, because in our case, after 90 days, we write off our loans, and they compare it with opposition companies and even overseas companies, which got a completely different way of providing and writing off. So that was an issue, but we've given a detailed answer on that. And then on our multi-land product that we had, which the NCR did a full investigation on the multi-land product, approved the product and said they're happy with the product. They're stating that it was not in the best interest of the client. As you all know, we're currently in 4 or 5 court cases in that. The one was happening this week, and my information at this stage is that is postponed for indefinite period. And then there was a lot of other smaller allegations that was made by so I think what is important is in the last 2 months what we have done, each and every one of those allegations, we've basically gone to the smallest detail in the majority of cases back as far as 5 years to go and check if we've done anything wrong. Is there somewhere error? Is there something, a mistake, to double check to make certain we are fine? We are busy with our audit process, and our auditors have taken the same approach, and they will bring out their audit report on Monday when our financial results will come out. And then on a regular basis, the different regulators are going through our numbers and our figures. So we're quite convinced we've got nothing to hide. If I look at Viceroy, and I think for me this is the important point, we've mentioned that there's many people or analysts that's bringing out reports. We need to understand what they are doing. They are shorting. They are making a profit out of it. So it's in their best interest to create a market where the price will drop. And even in certain instances, they've gone long, so they've gone the opposite. Our biggest concern is actually lying in the fact that if you look at other companies that they have attacked, it's companies where products are being sold, retail products, so the consumer can decide if he wants that product, yes or no. In our case, we're selling trust. As a bank, you're selling trust. And if you're creating uncertainty for a depositor, he's asking, why should I put my money in? So that's why for us why it's extremely important to handle this with very carefully to make certain that we answer all the allegations. Because it was mentioned here that especially your smaller deposit people are people that will easily run away. That's why I think it's important that the FSB do a full investigation. We've laid a formal complaint with the FSB that they really understand who they are, how they're operating, and what is the credibility. So from our side, I think if you go and look at what we've done in the last 2 months,
you're at 17.5 minutes, eh?
Okay, I'm basically finished. If you looked at what we have done, every single allegation they've made, we've given a detailed answer on those allegations, which is published on SENS and is available for the public. Thank you very much.
VBS Mutual is a very different case, but to manage the meeting, it's only initial foray, we decided let's take both. Because there's a view that somehow Capitec is being protected and VBS is being let to slide. And so let's look at both issues. That was the rationale, wrong as it may be, but here we are. Over to VBS Mutual. Where are you? Alan? They agreed to come. They said they're not coming. So that's the curator, but the bank? Oh, you see, in other words, I understand what you're saying now. You're saying when you spoke to the creator, you're really speaking to VBS Mutual, right? That's it. Okay, fine. It reinforces the view. You see, I thought the original board was going to come here because they had in the public domain, right? Remember, a thousand things have been happening in our lives as well. Unlike you, Momo, we have no staff as chairs. We battle with the excellent few people we have. So let me tell you, I didn't understand. There's a million things happening. Right. See, I thought the board of, and it's not Alan's fault. We have a million exchanges over the phone, Saturday and Sunday, Sunday as well with him. Now, it's a bit curious now. Who's going to present the case then of VBS Bank, the bank that was actually taken over, the board was taken over by a curator. That bank should be allowed. Capitec is here. Why is VBS Mutual not here? Yeah, that's what you were saying. See, I thought the curator is not here, but the board members will speak for themselves. Who are the board members? And in theory, in law, are they still the board members? Can you clarify? So why are they not here?
So let me just clarify, because these are obviously two different sets of issues.
Yeah.
When a bank is put under curatorship, firstly, it's a less extreme form than put it into liquidation, okay? But when you put it under curatorship, basically the function of the board and top management ceases, right? So the curator becomes effectively like the CEO. Let Kuben come in, but still under the guidance of he reports to the registrar, but he's appointed by the minister. Okay, so if you remember when we went dealt with African Bank, I'm not sure if the former CEO or the board also... Yeah, okay.
You're saying we don't know. Okay. The question is, what in law and what within the rules of Parliament precludes the bank board, such as it was, appearing before Parliament to present its case, to say, we don't think we should have been put under curatorship. We think this, you know, there is a view that's expressed in the public domain by the board and the CEO or managers. They're saying they're getting a raw deal. Now, we can't hear the curator alone. I thought the curator was here meant to be in addition to the board members of VBS.
So now
legally, does the board exist?
So
yeah, hang on. Now, let me get some clarity. Legally, does the VBS board exist?
Yes.
That's even more reason why, colleagues, they should be here. What is going on here? Okay, can we get members quickly? In other words, am I right to say, colleagues, save a lot of time? If the curator is not here, even more importantly, the VBS bank members should be here. Alan, didn't you show me some exchanges? I don't read them all with the bank itself, originally. So what happened to those people? Let's get clarity on what happened, please.
Yeah,
right? No, I'm ruling that we need to know what happened first, because members don't know, nor does the chairperson. So let's hear what happened. Didn't you invite...
Yes, the correspondence I sent to the CEO's PA in the hope that, you know, the board members or the CEO would be here, and they then, by the looks of it, pass it on to the curator.
I saw the replies. Look, I'm looking at my iPhone with a million emails. I saw the VBS guy reply. I thought he was saying they're going to come, they're going to send somebody, and then they hand it over to the curator. Okay, right, over to members. Floyd Ajana first, Tandy, Mr. Schlengwa.
I think what happened, not even think, I know what happened is that the Allen invited the curator because when the governor of the Reserve Bank announced the curatorship, said that the board and the management are released of their responsibilities in the bank, and the curator is going to take charge of all activities of the bank. And then the curator was told by the registrar of banks to say that he doesn't have to come to this meeting. That is what happened. But I think we should still call the CEO of VBS and the chair of the board and whoever board member to come and give us their side of the story so that we're able to deal with the issues that might arise out of that.
The question is, though, the fact is, he did write to the board. He did get a reply from one of the senior managers. I saw it, and I'll forward it to you. What happened between then and last night is something else. On the matter of the curator, that's a separate issue. That was an exchange between the curator and Mr. Naidu. That's a separate issue. But I thought the board was going to be here. Alan, it's not your fault. Look, let's not persecute Alan. Ultimately, I'm responsible, right? I should have checked, okay? Is everybody here? But he said everybody's here, and one takes it, and he's always right. So the first time he gone wrong, I don't want to blame Kuben for that. Actually, it's between Alan, the board, and ourselves, and Floyd's right, we'll have to do it. Tandy.
Chair, I need to be corrected, and I don't know, because we don't have our lawyers here. You see, my understanding, Kuben, of curatorship is that once an institution is put under curatorship, its leadership does not exist. It does not, because it could not govern itself. Therefore, it's going to be governed by another component that's going to direct them to how they must do work properly. So, once you have a curator and a board in the same meeting, going to discuss mitigating factors of a failed institution, it's contradictory, in my opinion. Because you're going to have a board that has failed to explain itself, well, unless you want to ask it why it failed, then that's fine. Because it's not going to be able to explain to you how it's going to succeed because it has failed. Therefore, you need to allow the curator space to help it to succeed. That's what we did with the bad bank of the African Bank when we intervened
as a South African Reserve Bank. The curator came in, took responsibility, decided how it's going to be liquidified, put on strategies on how to prevent. We discussed through the Act how to deal with such occurrences not happening in future and so on. Now we need to make a distinction what we want to discuss. And as we do that, Chair, we should also be careful whether we are not going to discuss strategies in the process inadvertently as we try to get to difficult answers. Thanks.
Okay, Lisa had something to say?
Yeah.
Okay, look, the only... Oh, Mr. Schlengwa, sorry, and Peggy here.
Chair, it's not really going to be long. I think the unfortunate part is that we did not get a response to the question Honorable Lee asked earlier on in terms of what capacity the registrar was here. In what hat is he wearing? I think that adds to the confusion. Secondly, Chair, I think we will end up clogging a dead horse. We might as well support what Ferd has said and call the bank, but and then emphasize the registrar to resist the temptation to want to be a player and a referee in a parliamentary process. Thanks, Chair.
Well, hang on, Kubin. You will have to wait your place, wherever you are.
Thanks, Chair. I think we're all laboring under the impression that VBS board was here. Because we would really love to engage them. There are perceptions out there that needs to be cleared. So I would love to support Floyd so that and propose that we invite VBS to the meeting, to the next meeting.
Mr. Naidoo?
Chair, I think it's a little unfair not to have given me an opportunity to respond to Alan originally. Because it's now been...
The routine of Parliament. You can't decide. No, you can't decide.
It's now been stated three times that I instructed someone...
No, I clarified that.
In Parliament.
Yeah.
That's not correct, Chair. It's not correct. I've had at least half a dozen conversations with you in the last 2 or 3 weeks. At no stage did you tell me that you've invited the curator. Right? I'm just saying, you don't have to. I didn't know that the curator was invited.
6 days ago, right?
Right? I'm saying I didn't know that the curator was invited.
You don't have to know, yeah, but,
right?
You know, that's between you and the curator.
I told the curator I'm going to Parliament. He said, do you think I should come with? I did not know that he was formally invited
to phone
this
me?
Committee. I said, no, I don't think you should go with. I did, if you had
oh,
told
let's not
me...
Cover, no, let's not cover that ground. We don't agree with you. None of us does. And you should know better, Kobayan, somebody of your
Chair.
Experience of Parliament.
Chair, my deputy registrar asked me the same thing. Do you think I should come with you to Parliament? I said no.
A deputy?
Yes.
That's different.
Yeah, but it's the same context.
No, it's not. Come in. Let's not. I'm not actually allowing this conversation from you any further.
Okay, Chair,
right.
I respect that.
Right,
on VBS, the legal situation is as follows, that there is a board and there is a CEO of VBS. From the moment that the bank is placed under curatorship,
There is
a board and there is a CEO. From the moment that the bank is placed under curatorship, the board and the CEO are relieved of their duties in respect of running the bank. I still think, I agree with you, that I think it will be in the public interest for you to ask the board and the CEO to explain certain things in public. But we have had no contact, and they are not here, not because of anything we have said.
We understand. Okay, can I suggest something? See, Tandi is right in what she says, but Floyd and everybody else are also right. We think slightly different things. Tandi, you see, in the case of African Bank, the bank didn't question their curatorship, okay? It said, yeah, okay, we accept the curatorship. Here, all I can tell you is what I read in the newspapers. I don't listen much to radio, right? And I don't watch much TV, but I read a lot. And I can tell you that they themselves had a whole lot of issues. They were taking you to court, not you, the state, to court, right? So African Bank didn't do all those things. The investors did it, Tandi. So I think, Tandi, you are right, actually, in principle. But let me suggest, and let's talk outside this meeting, right? Let's try to persuade each other. A decision is a majority decision that we should go ahead and invite them. And even Mr. Naidoo is agreeing, of all people, right? So what I'm saying, Tandi, is that we mustn't set precedents, you're right.
Yeah, okay, no, but it's not, look, you're helping us to clarify. It's very helpful input you made, which I knew, but you put it very nicely and precisely. So, what is it? We're saying that in principle, what Tandy is saying is correct, and all the qualifications she's added are also, in my view at least, my personal view, correct. But in view of the specific circumstances here that are different from the African Bank, in that, one, the board members who are claiming that they're being discriminated, rightly or wrongly, discriminated against because they're a black bank, they're a mutual bank, there's an argument they should be opened up and become an ordinary bank, they've applied for a license, all of those things, right? Secondly, there are people who are shareholders who took you to court and then you negotiated, mercifully, some deal, right? So for those and other reasons, and given our obsession, if you want to call it that, rightly so, that 23 years later, look at the banks of our country, right? All of those circumstances, not least a framework provided by our financial sector transformation report, agreed to by all parties but the DA, we have said, in future, Tandy, all our programs, up till the day this parliament drops dead, so to speak, we will focus on these issues. So for those reasons, Tandy's right, I agree. Well, at least I think she's absolutely right. It's very valuable, but these are the... And you're not saying don't call them. So let's agree,
clarify,
we're calling them for the reasons we've set out.
Yeah, let's be
clarified.
At least I misconstrued something else. You see what I'm saying? I'm saying we need to be clear what are the issues that we're going to get involved. Because remember, there's a litigation process. They are saying they want to take them to court. Once you do that, there'll be certain things that certain people might not want to disclose and discuss in a meeting of this nature.
Qualifications, you said. Okay,
absolutely.
Well, ask Zakhele to
so
draw
saying,
up a thing, yeah.
Yes,
good,
saying,
that'll
let's
help us. Exploit. It's fine. We will collectively look at what Zakhele draws up.
There's no litigation that is ongoing on the creditorship. As a matter of fact, there's no litigation. Yeah. So let us get those that were leading the bank to come and give their side of the story. And then we'll detect the consistency of the Reserve Bank and National Treasury in terms of how does it place banks under creditorship and what mechanism does it put in place. Does it necessarily protect depositors or just recklessly do it?
That's exactly what we're looking at. Freud's right. Let's move on. SARB, over to you. You've got 20 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to check, the committee has received my presentation. Yeah. Okay, Chair, so I will take the presentations as read. I'll try and split my time roughly equally between Capitec and VBS, if that's acceptable to you, Chair. Sure. Chair, I'm going to do a preamble, I guess, to explain what the role of a regulator and a supervisor is. It's an ongoing process of supervising banks. We attempt to enforce the laws, the regulations, and we take a forward-looking approach. We attempt to predict if there'll be a problem in the future. We receive data from the banks on a monthly basis. Sometimes those are audited, so the annual financial statements, for example, are audited, but a lot of the information that we receive on a monthly basis is not necessarily audited. We rely on a basis of trust between the bank and the supervisor, although some of the data we can verify through independent parties. For example, if a bank tells us that they've got X amount of money in cash, we can check their overnight accounts on the settlement system to verify that, and we do that on a frequent basis. Chair, banks fail or succeed based on their own strategic choices, and I think that that's a very important point to remember. Banks don't fail because something that the regulator does. They fail because of their own strategic choices. The process of supervision is that we do not run banks. We supervise the management. We supervise the boards, but they run the banks. The only time we can take over the running of the bank is under curatorship, right? And that's the only legal way in which we can actually instruct or do something ourselves if we put the bank under curatorship. Otherwise, those decisions are executed through management and the board. And as Mr. Mamoniad said, the process of curatorship is a step before liquidation. Chair, let me deal with the Capitec issue. At 10 minutes to 10 on that day, I don't remember the exact date, I think it was 30th of January, I received a phone call from a journalist saying that Viceroy are about to issue a report. Do I have a comment? I said I've got absolutely no comment. I haven't even seen the report. At 4 minutes to 10, I received the report, and the report was made public at 10 o'clock. We had to read the report fairly quickly and make an assessment of what we think the high-level issues are. I should point out that for all intents and purposes, Capitec is a systemically significant bank in our context. There are three main allegations in the Capitec, in the Viceroy report on Capitec. These issues are not necessarily new. We have been discussing similar issues with the bank for a long time. We asked many of the similar questions a long time. Chair, I have in my hand all the research reports on Capitec that have been published by banks in the last 6 months alone. Right? There are dozens of reports that are issued on Capitec by Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Standard Bank Securities, UBS, Renaissance Capital, etc. Deutsche Bank, they've all released research reports on Capitec in the last 6 months. Chair, the three main allegations in the report are as follows. The first is, does this bank unfairly reschedule loans to artificially boost repayments and new loans? So the allegation is as follows. If you owe the bank 100 Rand, I give you a 120 Rand loan, but I just give you 20 Rand cash. It looks as though you fully repaid the 100 Rand loan, and it boosts your loan repayments, but it also boosts new loans because I'm not giving you a 20 Rand loan, I'm giving you a 120 Rand loan. The second main allegation in the Viceroy report is that the bank uses rolling over of loans or rescheduling loans to artificially reduce how much of provisions they have to keep. So to simplify things, if somebody's missed one payment, you've got to raise provisions, let's say, to 40% of the value of the loan. If they've missed two payments, it's 70%. If it's three payments, it's 100% of the value of the loan. The allegation is that the bank deliberately reschedules loans to reduce the amount of provisions that they have to keep. The third main allegation in the Viceroy report is that the bank has a product called a multi-loan product, which effectively means that they charge people an origination fee multiple times to increase the average margin on the loan. Chair, on the third issue, that is something that the National Credit Regulator is looking into and is investigating. I won't comment on that. On the first two allegations, based on the information that we have, this is not the case. The allegations contained in the Viceroy report are not correct. The bank does not unduly reschedule loans and does not use loan rescheduling to reduce the amount of provisions that they have. To conclude on Capitec, the CEO disclosed what their capital adequacy ratio is there. They have a capital adequacy ratio of 34%. That's 2.5 times what a normal bank has, and that's because of the risk profile that the bank has. So the bank is very well capitalized relative to other banks. I should also state that they have a liquidity coverage ratio of well over 1,000%, even though the minimum is 100%. So, Chair, in our opinion, Capitec, the key allegations against Capitec in the Viceroy report are not correct. Capitec is well regulated. They have adequate capital and adequate liquidity. Chair, I should also state that as part of the ongoing supervisory process, we will continue to look at these issues. We will continue to use independent verification of these issues. But, Chair, based on the information that we have, the key allegations in the Viceroy report are not accurate. Chair, let me turn now to VBS. We've been engaging with VBS for about 18 months on what we saw as significant risk in the bank. And the risk is as follows. The bank has taken on an increasing number of municipal deposits, a small number of very large municipal deposits, and they lend the money long term. Typically, these municipal deposits are short term in nature. And if you've got 100,000 deposits of short term in nature and you're lending long term, in some ways, your risk is lower because the risk that all 100,000 would come and ask you for the money at the same time is fairly limited. But VBS had 21 depositors at the time of curatorship to the value of over 1.2 billion rand. So the average municipal deposit there was over 50 million. for the last 18 months, we've been engaging with the bank, saying that this is a risky strategy to take what is effectively short-term municipal deposits and lend it long-term. This bank has had four what I would call liquidity events in the national payment system. The Reserve Bank runs SAMOS, the overnight settlement system, and on four occasions, the 16th of February was the fourth occasion, where they effectively didn't have money in the overnight settlement system to settle a payment. So somebody issued a check, and effectively it's the equivalent of them not having money in the bank to honor the check. Chair, we've been engaging with the bank repeatedly, advising them to reduce the risk, the concentrated nature of their deposits. We now know that what they've done is the exact opposite. Whether the Treasury issued their circular on municipalities or not, our view was that this was a risky business, to take such large short-term deposits and lend them long-term. However, Chair, from the time that the Treasury had issued their circular in August last year, so on the 5th of September, VBS had 13 municipal deposits to the value of 1.2 billion rand. By the end of the year, they had 16 municipal deposits to the value of 1.5 billion rand. So not only did they not heed our advice and reduce the concentration risk that they faced, they actually went in the other direction. They increased the number of municipal deposits after the Treasury had issued their circular, both in terms of volume and in terms of the quantum of money. Chair, we've been encouraging VBS for the last 2 years to apply for a commercial banking license. There are two reasons why we've been doing this. The first is that we think they've become too big for a mutual bank. The regulatory framework for a mutual bank is relatively limited. And a commercial banking license will give us greater intrusive powers of supervision and greater legal means to raise concerns, to raise capital levels, to raise liquidity levels, given the risk profile of the bank. The Mutual Banks Act, unfortunately, doesn't allow us to do that. Chair, on the 27th of February this year, the bank applied for a banking license. Right? However, it takes 12 to 18 months to process a banking license. And so, with the best will in the world, they'll not be able to get a banking license in the short term. Chair, we put this bank under curatorship not because we wanted to. We are not happy that this bank has failed. This bank has failed because board and management repeatedly refused to heed our advice and heed our recommendations that they reduce the concentration risk on the deposit side. We are managing now a very fragile liquidity position. Based on the data that the banks give us, we thought that there was a certain amount of cash in the bank. Upon arrival, the curator has found that there is far less cash in the bank. And so we've had to manage liquidity very tightly. We've had to put limits on withdrawals. These are harmful. These are painful to people. We understand that. The job now of the curator is attempting to manage that liquidity situation, see what assets the curator can liquidate quickly. We might even have to see what other means we can to support the liquidity of the bank to be able to provide depositors with funds. I understand that the curator has raised the limit for funeral policies, but the 1,000 rand withdrawal limit is still in place. We hope that as the liquidity situation improves in the days and weeks going forward, those issues will be resolved. Chair, I just want to spend a couple of minutes on the sequence of events leading up to the curatorship, because I think this is an important matter for the committee. As I said, on the 16th of February, the bank suffered what we would call a liquidity event. They ran out of money on the overnight settlement system. We immediately called the bank and we gave them 48 hours to put in place a liquidity recovery plan. The bank effectively said that the two major shareholders, Vele Investments and the PIC, is prepared to put in additional money, but that they're not yet ready to do that. We gave them a further period to do that, but the liquidity situation of the bank was getting worse and worse. On the Thursday before the curatorship, we had a meeting between the National Treasury, the board of the bank, the management of the bank, and at that point we said, look, if there isn't money forthcoming, we have no choice but to put the bank under curatorship. The bank said, give us until Monday morning. Right. On the Friday, the chair of the bank released a letter, an open letter, which effectively said that the Reserve Bank was about to put the bank under curatorship. That put us in a very difficult position. We had an agreement that we will wait until Monday morning, but we now have it in the public domain that the bank is about to be put under curatorship. We spoke to the largest investors, Vele Investments and the PIC, and they both said that they do not have money to put in by Monday morning. So on Sunday, we took the decision to put the bank under curatorship immediately. We had to do that before the branches opened on Monday because it was in the public domain that the bank was suffering from liquidity squeeze and that the bank was about to be put into curatorship. Chair, according to the Banks Act, the old Banks Act said that we needed the consent of board and management to put the bank under curatorship. The Banks Act was amended so that the Minister of Finance does not need the consent of the board and management to put the bank under curatorship. We merely need to notify them in writing of our intent to put the bank under curatorship. So, Chair, on the Sunday, I phoned both the Chair and the CEO, verbally informed them that we plan to put the bank under curatorship. I then wrote to both the Chair and the CEO, informing them that we intend to put the bank under curatorship. And it was only after those letters went out that we formally put the bank under curatorship. And as I said, Sizwe Nsaluba Gobodo has been appointed as a curator. The company, it's quite unusual to appoint a company. Normally you appoint an individual. However, our interpretation of the law is that we can appoint a juristic person as the curator. So SNG has been appointed curator, represented by Mr. Anush Ruplau, who heads their financial services practice. And they have been in curatorship since last week, Sunday. Chair, let me leave it at that for now. And take any questions.
The FSB? Oh, National Credit Regulator, sorry, NCR. Where are you? Ah, there you are. John, that we're asking you over. And you're coming next week, I think, also at sign-off, is that correct?
No.
No. Oh, no, it's not you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and good morning, Honorable Members. My name is Nomsa Motsekgare. I'm the National Credit Regulator CEO. I'm here with my colleague, Mr. Lisiba Mashapa, who is the company secretary. I'm going to take you through a presentation relating to VBS Mutual Bank and Capitec because these two banks are registered and are regulated by the National Credit Regulator. Now, the outline of the presentation is that I'll take you through our compliance monitoring tools, but also touch on VBS Mutual Bank in terms of their compliance with the National Credit Act, and statistical trends. With that, I will also present compliance of Capitec Bank with the National Credit Act. Now, in terms of the main tools that we use in regulating, this industry, as I indicated, the National Credit Regulator operates under the ambit of the National Credit Act, Act 34 of 2005. We regulate credit providers, credit bureaus, debt counselors, and debt counselors are individuals who assist over-indebted consumers. We regulate payment distribution agents and alternative dispute resolution agents. The compliance tools that we use within the NCR is that we rely on complaints that we receive from consumers. We also use, we also conduct compliance monitoring exercises in terms of compliance visits or desktop compliance, where we would ask for certain documentation from the different registrants that we regulate.
We also rely on the accounting officers and auditors that are appointed by registrants to submit assurance and statements to the NGR on an annual basis. And this is in these reports that is where they will indicate areas of non-compliance. We also conduct investigations and enforcement. The different enforcement tools that we use would either be in the form of instructional letters where we would ask a registrant to comply within a certain time frame, failing which we then issue a compliance notice, also requiring the registrant to comply within a certain time frame, failing which we would then refer the matter to the National Consumer Tribunal, which would either, you know, impose a fine, cancel the registration of a registrant, or even, you know, there are some certain prayers that we would ask for, including delisting of consumers from credit bureau records and getting, you know, their judgment debt rescinded. We also make use of statistical returns where we look at trends. These statistical returns are published by the National Credit Regulator in the media on a quarterly basis, and therefore they're available to anyone who's interested to see what the level of, you know, indebtedness is in the country, together with the different credit products that are offered, for instance, by credit providers. Now, in terms of EBS Mutual Bank and their compliance level, we have not, since they were registered in 2007, received any complaints relating to VBS Mutual Bank. And in terms of our compliance monitoring, this really mainly talks to their statutory documents that they are required to submit to the NCR. They are always on time. They pay their renewal fees on time. The two assurance engagement reports that we received from the auditors in the past 2 years, for 2016 and 2017, did not indicate any areas of non-compliance with the National Credit Act. And we have not instituted any formal investigations, you know, relating to VBS Mutual Bank. Now, just to give you an indication of what type of bank this is and what product offerings they have, you may not, the figures there may not be legible, but, you know, I have the information here with me in case you want to find out what the gross value of the debtors book in relation to the different products that they offer. Their main product offerings range from mortgage loans to secured credit and unsecured credit. They don't offer any credit facilities and they don't offer any short-term credit. Now, short-term credit in our classification refers to loans that are up to 8,000 rands, repayable over a period of 6 months, and the interest rates that registrants are allowed to charge are maximum of 5% for the first loan, and that comes down to 3% for the second credit agreement. Now, in terms of VBS, this is just to give you an indication of how, for instance, the mortgage loans and secured credit has gone up over a period of time. They were sitting at about 425 million. That's the cumulative number of mortgages that they extended to consumers. And secured credit is mostly driven by vehicle finance. Normally, we classified furniture loans and vehicle finance under secured loans. So secured loans there that is in red is mostly driven by motor vehicle finance. These are the average loan sizes that they offer in terms of mortgage loans and secured credit. As you can see, the red, which is unsecured, is very, very, very minimal. They don't really offer a lot of unsecured credit. Now, the average size of their mortgage loans sit at around 3.2 million. And secured credit average loan size is about 1.8 million. And in terms of the gross debtors book, which is the number of accounts that they have loaned out, you can see that in terms of mortgage loans, they range around, you know, there are about 700 of those loans on a quarterly basis. Secured, as I said, which is mostly driven by motor vehicle finance, is really sitting at, by the end of September 27, it was sitting at around 246 of these loans that were extended towards motor vehicle finance. Now, if you look at the rand value of gross debtors book share by banks that are registered with the NCR, we have about 27 banks that are registered with the NCR. Banks own about 82% of the 1.7 trillion debtors book in the country. They own about 81%. Now, VBS Mutual Bank has only 0.05% share of that of the bank's credit book. Capitec Bank has 3.24% of the bank's share of the debtors book. So you can clearly see that VBS Mutual Bank, in our analysis, in our world, is a very small bank. And VBS mostly lends to consumers in rural areas and townships. Now, let's get to Capitec Bank. And in terms of their compliance levels, during 2017, we received about 90 complaints, and 86% of these complaints were resolved. As at February, we were sitting at only an outstanding of 17 complaints that we are still that are still in work in progress. In general, the nature of complaints against banks relate to reckless lending, dispute on outstanding balances and terminations from debt review. During 2017, we conducted a compliance monitoring exercise on the banks in general. After we received in the media the Wells Fargo debacle that was reported in 2016. This is an American international bank where employees in the bank were incentivized to chase targets and therefore ended up, forcing consumers to take up additional loans. In some instances, they were even creating ghost accounts because they were looking to get bonuses. The bank was charged, given a very huge fine in the U.S. by the regulator. For that reason, we started getting worried about that story, and we decided to do a compliance check in South Africa. We looked at all the four big banks plus African Bank and Capitec to see whether the practice had not started in South Africa. And therefore, in our analysis, what we picked up at Capitec was the fact that multiple loans were being extended to consumers. You'd have one consumer being given 6 or 7 loans in 1 month. I think it is important to mention that none of those loans were found to be reckless, in the sense that affordability assessments were conducted. We were just worried about the fact that even though the act was not contravened, but the fact that these consumers were given too many loans in 1 month may pose a risk in future for the consumers and the banks. And this information we obviously shared with the Capitec management and the Reserve Bank. And in terms of the assurance engagement report, which I indicated is submitted to the NCR by the auditors on an annual basis, for 2 years in 2016 and 2017, they did not report any areas of non-compliance with the National Credit Act. Now, in terms of investigations, these two matters are already in the public domain. There's one matter that we investigated where, we referred a multi-loan product, and these were loans that were given through ATMs to the National Consumer Tribunal. And we lost the case because of the fact that, the tribunal had indicated that we did not have any reasonable suspicion to have investigated that particular product. We therefore lost the case. This was further confirmed by the High Court on appeal. In the second matter, we did have a complaint around the same product, but however, our investigation revealed that there were no issues of non-compliance. This is as far as I go, Honorable Chair. I thank you.
I apologize. I have to speak to our excellent content advisor. He's got to get something done by 13:00. And I couldn't drink my tea because of the infighting here between Treasury and the members. So I listened to everything you say. Just to, you may not know me, but I've been in Parliament since 1994. And if you've been here for 23 years, you can multitask. And I can repeat 90% of what you said. If you want to challenge me, we can go outside this meeting. But I know what you said. I want to tell you, I expected none of them to use up 20 minutes. I knew this was going to happen, but we gave them the latitude. We're now dealing with the final two, FSB and National Treasury. Who is FSB here? Ah, there we are. You want to speak from there?
Chair, thank you. Chair, I'm Jürgen Boyd, one of the deputy executive officers at the FSB. I'm also the acting registrar of securities of the financial market of security services. Our interest in the Capitec matter relates to possible contravention of the Financial Markets Act insofar as the possible publication of false, misleading, or deceptive information. Should I start again, Chair? My name is Jürgen Boyd, Deputy Executive Officer at the Financial Services Board. I'm currently the Acting Registrar of Security Services. Our interest in the Capitec matter, on which we're going to speak about now, relates to possible contraventions of the Financial Markets Act insofar as there could have been possibility of publication of false, misleading, or deceptive information. With me is one of our senior forensic investigators, Iris van Kerken, and he'll take us through a presentation of the work that we've done since the issue around Capitec broke sometime early January. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I can confirm that we did receive a complaint from Capitec and that the complaints were registered on the same day that the complaints were received. As Mr. Boyd indicated, these complaints relate to insider trading, the publication of false, misleading, or deceptive statements, and also prohibited trading practices. So, as he indicated, as a regulator, we are somewhat constrained in what we can disclose. So, just to explain to you why we do have jurisdiction to look at these complaints, Capitec Bank Holdings is a listed security on the JSE. So the FSB has jurisdiction to investigate whether the FMA was contravened. Following our investigation, the matter can go two ways. The one is to criminal prosecution, and the other is an administrative penalty that can be imposed by the FSB Enforcement Committee. We always publish the outcome of any regulatory action that we take, and we don't make any exception on that. So the status of the investigation is basically just to study the Viceroy reports that were published. We are studying Capitec's responses to those reports. There's various information that the complainant has provided to us. We are looking at analyst reports, media reports, and we're also following this matter in social media. You'll note some of the participants in it are quite active on Twitter, etc. So we are following those engagements. Then we are also looking at the activities of trading in Capitec shares, debentures and bonds and other derivatives. Mr. Chair, as you correctly indicated, short selling in itself is not necessarily illegal, but we are doing that to understand who the group is and what is exactly happening in this matter, what anybody's motive may be to say something negative or perhaps what they said is truthful, and we will look at that aspect as well. So what we've done is we've used some of our investigation powers. We've issued summonses. We've interrogated the first suspect in this matter, and we intend to issue further summonses to interrogate persons that we believe may be able to furnish information relevant to our investigation. We are also liaising with fellow regulators that include the foreign regulators, such as the Financial Conduct Authority in the United Kingdom and the Securities and Exchange Commission. As you will appreciate, certain information that we might require for our investigation is actually found in those jurisdictions, and we need their assistance to gather that information for us. Mr. Chair, thank you. That's just a short oversight of where we are. Are there any questions?
You want to say something?
Chair Olano Makubela, Deputy Executive Officer for Retirement Funds at the Financial Services Board.
Chair, so just a quick input around the exposure of retirement funds to VBS Bank. We have done some preliminary assessment, which indicates that the exposure in the form of deposits in VBS Bank by pension funds is quite limited. Of course, there is one fund which is already under curatorship, which has got quite a sizable deposit in VBS Bank. Thanks, Chair.
We'll come back with our questions. Then we have National Treasury.
Presentation, but we can certainly provide some info. Let me start by just starting with Capitec. I think the point has been made. Our first concern was that when Viceroy came with its report, if you read its footnote, what does it say, Bukile? Just read it. So the report was entitled A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing.
What?
Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. If you read the footnote right on the first page, which will circulate later, you'll wonder who the real wolf in sheep's clothing is, okay? Just read the... It's just instructive to read the footnote, Chair. I want to ask Bukile to read it. So this is what they say about themselves.
Says the report has been prepared for educational purposes only and expresses our opinion. The report and any statements made in connection with it are the author's opinion, which have not been based on publicly available facts, which have been based on publicly available facts, fields for research, information, analysis through our own due diligence process, and are not statements of fact. All expressions of opinions are subject to change without notice. We do not undertake to update or supplement any report or any of the information, analysis, and opinion contained in them. We believe that the publication is of our opinion about public companies that we research in the public interest. We are entitled
to... public interest, right? But go on later.
We are entitled to our opinion and to the right to express such opinions in a public forum. We can access any information or evidence cited in this report or that we relied on to write the report from information in the public domain. To the best of our ability, it goes on, Chair, to the best of our ability and belief, all information contained herein is accurate and reliable and has been obtained from public sources we believe to be accurate and reliable and whom are not insiders or connected persons of the stock covered herein or who may otherwise owe any fiduciary duty or duty of confidentiality to the issuer. We have a good faith belief in everything we write. However, all such information is presented as is without warranty of any kind, whether express or implied. Further goes on, in no event will we be liable for any direct or indirect trading losses caused by any information available in this report. Think critically about our opinions and do your own research and analysis before making any investment decisions. We are not registered as an investment advisor in any jurisdiction. By downloading, reading, or otherwise using this report, you agree...
Just get to the bit about where they would be making money as well.
Okay, so at the end of the disclaimer,
okay, but
read some of the stuff. It's fine. We get the truth.
Yeah. So I'm just saying what they say about their own report. So you see that they're not regulated. You see that they don't have any new information that's not available already to regulators and others. And in fact, though they say they act in a public interest, the line they have is they say that they use their information. Have you got the line? Just read that line. That's interesting. It's on your mic.
Ha, 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 ha.
like a professor. Is Professor Davidson here? I know. He's a very clever young man.
I think it's as the publication date of this report, you should assume that the authors have a direct or indirect interest / position in all stocks and or other options, swaps, and other derivative securities related to the stock and bonds covered herein, and therefore stand to realize monetary gains in the event that the price of either declines.
So the emphasis on the price decline. So fans of the shareholders, the pension funds that might have their money there, their aim is to make sure shareholders lose value, in which case they make money. Okay. Secondly, of course, in the way they released the report, was done in a very reckless manner. If they were really concerned about the credit practices of Capitec, and let me say, we as Treasury, we are always concerned about the credit practices of all these institutions. Okay. But if they were really concerned about that, you would take it up in a different way, in a more constructive way, without bringing risk to the bank. And that was our problem. This is one of our large banks, and the point is that it is a SIFI, as we went through the Twin Peaks legislation, that it is a systemically important financial institution or bank, and there's no doubt if this bank went bust, or there was a run or whatever, then taxpayers would have to foot the bill to possibly save this bank. Okay, so certainly, I think when it's said, why did we act? We always act when there's any criticism on any bank. Criticism is fine, but if there's any potential run, we expect the regulators like Saab to act. Because if they don't act, and they don't act speedily, and bear in mind the words that we use with Twin Peaks, to act, they need to supervise intrusively, intensively, and effectively. Okay, that's the way you regulate all banks, big or small. Yes, there must be proportionality, but certainly if it's the SIFI, it's quite important that this has been done. So I think that when it gets to Viceroy in the first instance, and, you know, when they released the report, nobody even knew who the three directors were. This got exposed by the South African media. It was just done anonymously. So they not only were they not regulated, they were unknown. And in this instance, our first issue was, have they broken some laws? Because even if you say operate from the U.S. and you give investor advice, there may be some regulations that apply. Obviously, if they're doing it for a share in another country, that country may also have people who hold those shares. And it may be a regulatory gap, but we asked the FSB and the JSE to look into whether any laws like, you know, this is not insider trading, because they use public information and they put it out and then they probably invest. And it's not like they know any inside info. Technically, it's probably going to be difficult to find that they're breaking any law. And it's also a law of a cross-border in another country, so it has all those sorts of difficulties. And I think we were just trying to say, be careful of anyone who's screaming fire. Whether the fire is correct or not, anyone who screams fire can actually make the problem worse. There's a stampede, people run out, people get killed, people get hurt. And that's not the way you deal with regulatory problems. When it comes to Capitec, Chair, as I said, we certainly want all our regulators to be curious. Whatever's out in the public domain, they should read, they should check that there's compliance with the law. I think the registrars outlined that they've had complaints, they look at these issues. The NCR, we would expect them to act. And of course, once the market conduct regulator comes, together with the NCR, a lot of the issues raised are of a market conduct nature as well. And so you want to make sure that our regulators are acting without fear or favor and dealing with those issues. So we're not betting and saying, you know, X is not doing it. We're just saying, look, these are allegations. They're not being tested. And the way it's been done is in a reckless manner. and bear that in mind, and that they are playing the stock, and we need to look at mechanisms of how to protect from someone who's got a real financial interest in this matter. It's not defending the bank, but to the extent that we defend, we say that the regulators are looking into it, their financial state is healthy, it's often important that those sorts of statements are made to comfort the public when somebody screams fire. I think the VBS matter, of course, was a different type of matter. Here's not an outside analyst saying, you know, there's something wrong. In this instance, let me say, we only became aware, certainly as a treasury, that I guess in 2016, because they attracted attention because of one loan they made, there were questions in Parliament coming, yes, from opposition parties, asking us which municipalities hold their accounts. I think it, and I've got TB Pillay here as well, who deals with municipalities. Then we realized actually, and it's not that the MFMA forbids holding money in a mutual bank specifically. All it says is, and Chair, you were with me responsible for the MFMA.
No.
Oh, you weren't? Okay, I forgot. Okay. No, I'm joking. I had to say it. Okay. So, I am allowed to tease, I hope. So this was in the early 2000s, and it was in line with the PFMA. The wording is different from the PFMA, but the thrust of it is that your municipalities, public entities, departments, etc., must generally bank with a registered bank. And it's in terms of the Banks Act. It wasn't as specific in the PFMA. For 15 years, this law was not challenged. Okay, nobody said you're leaving us out. Because part of what we were looking at is you wanted overnight the deposits of these institutions that we expect not to run surpluses but to be spending all their money delivering services to keep their money in a safe position. That's why we don't allow them to go and make investments that may bring risk to that money. It's very regulated how they make investments and so on. So the first thing I want to clear up is that Municipal Finance Management Act does not forbid mutual banks. It doesn't allow you, it says you must only go to registered banks. And let me say, this is not an issue with provinces and national departments because overnight, all the money is swept and kept in the CBD accounts at the SARB. So, you know, even if a bank were to go bust, a province could have, you know, a huge equitable share allocation of a few billion rands, which if it got lost overnight would be a disaster. But all of that money is swept or is kept with the CBD. They just do small banking transactions through the commercial banking system. Your national and provincial and, of course, municipal entities and municipalities are the ones that tend to keep funds out of the Reserve Bank CBD system. So that's what we have to regulate, and there are regulations to cater for that. Second point to make, and Kuben has sort of made it, is that mutual banks are very lightly regulated. It's like cooperative banks. You hope that they take the step and that they build up and become fully commercial. That's what we would like, ideally. But that's the situation. So we became aware of the problem around October 2016 when the parliamentary question came. So it's not correct that we only realized when VBS told us that there was a problem. We then started talking to them because we were in a dilemma. If we then and then told municipalities to take their funds out, this bank would have gone bust. Okay, we didn't act. In fact, if we can be criticized, is that we didn't act quickly and swiftly to solve to get municipal funds out of VBS so that they could fully comply with the law. Okay, we didn't do that. Yes, we tried to talk to municipalities, and it's only in August that we sent a circular to 6 municipalities to say, are you aware, you know, this is the law? And if you look at the data we have, And I want to emphasize all the data we have is soft, because remember, we don't normally have such data. We've now had to ask municipalities, and there's also bank-client relationships. I don't know why they should be secret when it comes to a public institution. I think we should change that at some point in time. But what happened was that there was no immediate rush out of those accounts. That seems to have happened much later, in fact, early this year, a month after that circular, because we even stopped with that. I should add, you know, we've had legal action both from VBS threatening to take action, and we couldn't understand it. We responded because we said, surely a court is not going to sanction an illegal practice. Why are you running to court? You're actually bringing your own doom by doing so. That was my personal view. Indeed, even the court action last week, if they were to win, the problem is there'll be a run on a bank and they'll be liquidated. So curatorship actually helps them. So I'm not sure why anyone would contemplate legal action if they really thought through the issues. Chair, the issue then with VBS was, whilst we were talking, and yes, we've had quite a few meetings. Remember, they are, for example, mutual banks under Basel I, they don't do Basel III, etc. Suddenly this letter comes out, it was what, the Friday night, where, and Kubenz alluded to that, where he's literally saying he's going to be put under curatorship. It actually accelerated the process, spoilt our weekend. We had to then put them under curatorship, because when they opened their doors on Monday, they would have had a flood of people demanding their funds out. As it is, they were not paying out to depositors. So when municipalities and others were asking for their funds, they were not providing those funds. And let me say, Chair, we have real concern that there are, and there appear to be, governance issues. The chair of one of the big shareholders, Valley Finance, was the chair of the board. I'm not sure as I speak whether that there aren't real conflicts of interest, and we need to look at our regulatory system on whether that should be allowed. How do you make sure that the person then doesn't take funds from his investment company and puts it into his investment in the bank? You know, you need to check for those things. There needs to be walls. And as it is, and Olano's been modest, Mr. Makuvela, we are worried that there are the funds of orphans and pensioners up to just under 400 million rand. Mr. Makuvela can provide the actual figure. They are not covered by the 50,000 rand implicit deposit. That's only for retail investors. Similarly, Stockfels, if you left things as they are, may or may not be covered. Obviously, we are trying to look at it and trying to make sure that all your small players are not directly affected. But the only way you know these things, like the fact that even when VBS knew that it was wrong for municipalities to invest, it seems they were still touting for business from municipalities. That seemed to be their business model. And I think the registrars pointed out, aside from the issue of the fact that they were taking short-term money and making long-term loans, which all banks do, the problem in this case is they only have, you know, 20-plus big investors who do this, who in theory, by the end of the municipal financial year, should be have spent that money, and so that money would be called. What were they going to do? The Constitution doesn't allow municipalities to run an operational deficit. I think I've forgotten now, it's Section 2.2 something. So I think, Chair, there were big challenges for us, lots of questions, and these facts you only get to know when the curator now goes and you look at dates of things. So it was very convenient to say the Treasury caused this run. Even as I speak, we don't know whether we did or we didn't. I'm talking of inadvertently. But I suspect not. Sorry? Yeah, okay. So, Chair, I think the point I want to make is, at the moment, we do ask for the regulators to be given the space to do their work. We've told them, obviously, their approach at all times must be intrusive, intensive, and effective. And I want to make the point, regulators do not know everything. Yes, the fair question is, why do they not know? Is it because sometimes it's really people are concealing, it's not reasonable to know? But at some point, it's reasonable that by this time you should have known if you were regulating in an intrusive way. So at the moment, all our regulators obviously are looking at the VBS issue. I should add, Chair, we've had meetings with for example, the Office of the King of the Bavenda. We've talking to them. I think that there's you get surprise of information that people were clearly not properly informed on. And, you know, there are issues, like people have funds deposited and there's a funeral, what do you do with it? And obviously we expect the curator and the curator showing such sensitivity to deal with those issues. So it's still all, we're still finding out all the facts, but we thought that's what we should leave you. And we are checking whether there wasn't sort of effectively fraud committed in the process as well. We don't know either way, but those are things, you know, there seem to be funny things that certainly need to be explained. And what we have with any curatorship is once it's over, the curator will have a report, and at the same time, like with African Bank, you have, you know, a senior counsel doing an overall report like the Myberg report on African Bank, so that you get a full picture of who did what, when, who's responsible, what are the lessons to be learned, etc. And I want to end by making the point. The curatorship is here to save the bank. We are hoping that it will, the bank will be safe, that we find assets, that we find that there's no financial assets. And once we have the report, we know how big the problem is. Thank you.
Thank you, members. We've got an hour and 15 minutes. Floyd Tandy. Mr. Lees, Gwen, Mr. Slengwa.
Thanks, Chair. I honestly think that all the presentations that have been made here, particularly around Capitec, are not helpful, because instead of dealing with the substance of what Viceroy is raising, those who presented, including the Reserve Bank, National Treasury, is even dramatizing the lack of integrity of Viceroy and Capitec. But there are lots of substantial, correct issues that are raised by a Viceroy report, which you can run away from. It's common cause issues that have to be dealt with. One of those issues is the fact that Capitec, some of the directors that were in Capitec are those that have caused the creative accounting practices and pure corruption and fraud in Steinhoff. It's a fact, it's common cause, and you can't run away from that. That is what the Viceroy report starts by stating, and says that Capitec gives loans multiple times to one individual. The National Credit Regulator confirms that here. I don't know why she says that it's not against the law, because if you check Section 80 of the National Credit Act, it forbids some of the things that Capitec does. When there was a strike in Amplas in Rustenburg, Capitec gave 150,000 loans to 10,500 workers there on multiple occasions. So they give you a loan, when you fail to pay a loan, they give you a money to pay for that loan. And then you've got another one, when you're struggling, when you're about to default, they give you another one. That is what Capitec does. It's a loan shark. It's a pure machinist that is operating a loan system in a mining poor communities. That is not sustainable. So if you read that Viceroy report, they are not inventing things that are not existing. They take hot papers, which are a result of summit financial partners. We used to be the consumer protection advisors of Capitec. We used to be the ones who were supposed to be protecting consumers of Capitec. And they took Capitec to court and say that the lending practices of Capitec, they border on illegality and unlawfulness. And these affidavits that are in the Viceroy report, like let's remove the Viceroy name and everything else. Let's look into the substance of the issues that are being raised there. And they of course will be having some capital adequacy, because the people who are behind it, it's rich people, it's billionaires. We've got other business interests and everything else. But if it was operating independently out of its own dependence, it was not going to be in the situation that it is in Capitec now. So to create any other different imagination is misleading. The lending practices of a Let's perhaps make a follow-up meeting with about Capitec and call Summit Financial Partners, who are going to come and brief us here. Let's call some of the former employees of Capitec, who will come and tell us here of the practices of Capitec. That is what they do. They approve loans on the ATM and on the mobile app without going thoroughly to check whether that person who's going to get the loan, it deserves that money or can afford to repay that money. There's certain practices in terms of the National Credit Act which you have to necessarily verify as a person who gives loans, that make sure that this person can afford the loan and is not over indebted. But if I'm in the ATM and then it says that, do you want 5,000 rand loan, and I just click yes and then the 5,000 comes out there, with conditions that have not been clearly explained. The law says that a person who's given a loan should the person who gives the loan must make sure that the loan receiver adequately understands the conditions upon which they are receiving the loan. The Capitec doesn't do that. Because it's quick, you need the money, take it, and we'll meet later. And they charge crazy origin fees. What's the originating fees, like for the loan to be created there? So 23% of the incomes of Capitec, it's a fact. It's not created by Viceroy. It is in the financial statements that they are generating about 23% of their income from originating fees for loans, because they charge people unreasonable amounts. So when they give you 6 loans, every time they give you a new loan, they charge you for that particular activity. So we need a thorough analysis, a deeper analysis of the practices of Capitec. It's not different from what African Bank was doing at all in terms of its practices. And if it was not insulated by its billionaire owners, it was going to be having the same crisis that the African Bank is having. I think we need to make a thorough follow-up. Let's see the report which they claim they've written, the detailed report, which reports to each and every paragraph of, and the court papers that Viceroy has put there. And we see if that is adequate. I'm not convinced at all that Capitec should continue to exist under the current management and current practices, because it's a pure loan shark which is indebting our people, which is taking advantage of their moneylessness and abusing them through some credit scheme that is not legal. It's not lawful at all, and we must deal with that. And that is the issue that concerns us, Che. The issue of VBS is that an understanding of a curatorship is that it has to fundamentally protect the depositors. When we were forced to pass a special legislation and amend laws to save African Bank here, and even got other banks, the PIC put 2.5 billion, National the Reserve Bank put 5 billion rands, and the PIC put 2.5 billion, was to make sure that the depositors of African Bank are not jeopardized by the whole curatorship that happened. But the curatorship of VBS was not designed in that way. As a matter of fact, the Reserve Bank did not know, they did not do a proper due diligence and survey to check how much did the bank have before it was placed under curatorship. And I well, not even trying to protect those who owned the bank and the major shareholders, which includes the PIC, by the way. But the depositors are jeopardized now. The bankers, the people who have got bank accounts, the stock firms that have got bank accounts, the funeral policies that have got bank accounts at VBS cannot access their money. The curator doesn't have has put a ceiling of 1,000 rand, and people have got lives to live. They have to gain access to their money. Some receive debit orders. They do debit orders through VBS. They receive their salaries through it. But they cannot have access to that space because it's a black-owned bank. It doesn't matter. Let's just put it under curatorship. We'll see what are the consequences later on. We'll see if it has got money or not. It gets disrespected like that. And it's the clientele is rural people in any way. Rural mortgage, what is that? That is what we're dealing with of a reckless central bank that otherwise should have checked all the circumstances around VBS and made sure that even when curatorship happens, the boosters are not disorganized, are not displaced altogether in terms of access to their monies and everything else. You can do later on a recovery program that will reclaim the monies, even if you put your own money as a reserve bank or you get other shareholders to participate, like you were able to mobilize other banks to put money into the African bank, whoever you bring. But the depositors must not be in jeopardy. But we speak now. There is lots of frustration in Toyando, in Sibasa, in Makado, where the bank has got most of its clients. A lot of frustration, huge frustration. And you would know that there is some degree of loyalty to the bank because of its historical significance and everything else. People are not moving away from it. They're saying that, but we want our money. But the Reserve Bank, the curator is not there to could provide that insulation in terms of what is required. So clearly the whole process was handled wrongly. They were in a hurry, and it could have been dealt with far much more differently. The curatorship had to happen if indeed there was overexposure to one stream of depositors who were giving short-term deposit and then the bank was using it for long-term loans. In that context, it's understandable, but the manner in which the curatorship was handled is decidedly out of order. And also, I would think that I thought that when we're dealing with the financial, I'm concluding now, when we're dealing with the Financial Services Regulation Act, the prudential responsibilities that were placed on the Reserve Bank should have detected and prevented the whole crisis that defined VBS. Can just be boom, no, yeah, overexposed and all of those other things there. But also the role of National Treasury is suspicious because immediately there was exposure that one municipality has deposited money against the law, and which the National Treasury was aware last year, mid last year, July or August somewhere there. Why did the National Treasury stop that from the beginning, that this is against the law? You leave a bank, a black bank, accumulate municipal accounts up to 21 municipalities, and then you see, boom, all municipalities must withdraw their monies, and then the bank collapses. There is something wrong about the conduct of the National Treasury in terms of how the VBS dissolution, deliberate dissolution, was handled in terms of all these issues. And Che, I will tell you that we as the EFF, when VBS gave a loan to former President Zuma.
Can you tell them I'm not?
When we gave a loan to former President,
she'll be fine. We've been through this before. She'll be fine. Okay.
When VBS gave a loan to former President Zuma, we were the only political party that wrote to the National Credit Regulator to ask if that didn't amount to reckless lending. And the National Credit Regulator wrote to us to say that they did not see anything wrong with the loan, and we protect the bank on that basis that it is engaging in fair practices. But the role of National Treasury in allowing a bank to accumulate lots of deposits and later on dissolve it has to be explained further. Why did the municipalities get to 21? Why didn't they do anything about it if indeed the law... So the law says that a municipality can't bank with a mutual bank. You can only bank with the bank as registered by the Banks Act. So it's one of the issues that is suspicious, but also the solution that was provided by the Reserve Bank was not sustainable. I want to know, between your Thursday meeting, Kuben, and the curatorship day, when did the Minister of Finance give a go-ahead for the bank to be placed under curatorship? Did he write a letter to say that place the bank under curatorship, or he did it as a knee-jerk response to what he said was in the social media? Thank you very much.
Speak now or a bit later. Fine. Okay.
Sure. You see, the limitations of engaging at this point is that we don't have final report, which can be our basis of argument in terms of analyzing the situation of both banks. Sorry. But let me start with an anecdote, an anecdote that I want both, that I want both the Reserve Bank, the CFIUS, and everybody else who's here to take into account. It might sound not important for now, but later they will understand why I'm raising it. You see, if you are in a competitive environment, you'll find a situation where those who are in competition with you will either compete or sabotage you. If they can't rise to the level of competition, they will resort to easy and dirty mechanisms to try and make you not to exist. And South African business is not exempt to such behavior. And Chair, I'm saying this being consistent with what I said last week when I say we need to take with a pinch of salt things that come through the public discourse that comes as a form of information. We need to sift through it very carefully so that we need to know what is authentic, what is useful, and what can we work on. So that if we want to authenticate the input by Viceroy, tomorrow when we're held to account, we should be able to explain ourselves how did we arrive at a conclusion that that information is authentic. So I was not attacking the media last week. I was saying, let's be brief. If I was in a different meeting where there's not many people, I would have said some other things to say, let's even question the security of the information that is before us. But I'm not sure to which extent can I do it today. And I'm not making any input for now. I'm saying, let's be alive to that. Secondly, I feel vindicated in a way when people spoke here, because we're discussing an issue that relates to market conduct and how you deal with issues of market conduct. We have put through the Twin Peaks legislation, how we'll proceed about that. So when we speak, we should not speak as if the Twin Peaks legislation has not been passed by this parliament. But I'm going to ask questions to Capitec, to those who represent VBS, so that I clear my mind as we prepare for the discussions that will ensue at some point. And I'm going to start with this, to the gentleman who was presenting on behalf of Capitec.
You see, in the public discourse, you have financial development systems like the land bank, for instance. The land bank can roll loans because the development institution, okay? It can. But in relation to commercial banks, it's not expected. That's why we've got the National Credit Regulator to ensure that there's no multiple loans that are putting consumers at risk. And in relation to the Steinhoff matter, people were not disclosing information. I'm tempted to ask you, what position do you hold in Capitec? Because in the Steinhoff matter, even the auditors could not detect the activities of the executives. And I'm not insinuating anything in this current conjunction. All I'm saying is that in an event that the possibility that this might have happened, you have to look deeper into the systems and ensure that it's not done. You raise a fundamental issue that Viceroy looks at the higher earnings of companies. And that in itself speaks to the point I made earlier on, that if people can't compete with you and you are having high returns, they might want to do, and I'm not saying in this context that's what happened. But your credit granting methodology might be an issue that at some point National Treasury, the Reserve Bank, and National Credit Regulator might want to look into. So that when we look at the scope, we look at how recapitalization has been done for any other institutions, not one in particular, but any other institution. When it relates to the issue of BBS, I was, in fact, before we even go to BBS, you see, FSB says there's an insider trading matter, and I was tempted to ask the gentleman, are you a forensic auditor? I need that because it will help me to think about what I need to say. For you to help me.
My position is as a senior forensic investigator. My training, I do have accounting till about third year, and I've got law degrees, I've practiced in law, that's my background. And I've been with the FSB for about 6 years.
Thank you. You see, people like that don't just insinuate when they say there's an insider trade. Then, how would you say it in perfect English? Insider trader. Is that how you say it? Insider trading, Chair. You see, people who have done accounting to that level don't just insinuate that there is such. They will have looked at the listing at the JSC, correct? And found that there is.
Honourable Member, the position is that
it's not
yeah,
allowed.
Chair, I need to make my point.
No,
if
you allowed it, then everybody's allowed it. You allowed it last week because nobody was asking questions. It will not be appropriate, Thandi. Can we just move on? Ask your questions like everybody else does, and they will respond. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, I need to be helped on that specific point, because once there's an allegation that there's insider trading...
No, it's not going to be allowed. Let's not. We've discussed it this morning, that everybody's got to be treated fairly, and the committee chair is bound by the rules, and I've been instructed by both the House Chair and the Chief Whip to do that, and you can engage with them around it. Please, can we move on?
I'm sure you are misunderstanding, but I'm not saying you must answer on the spot. I'm saying I need, yes.
Floyd asked 5,000 questions, you can ask 5,000 too.
Chair, relax. I'm trying to ask those 5,000 questions. But I'm saying once that insinuation is made, it asks many questions. In relation to the NCR, I'm interested to know whether when you were doing assurance engagements, were these assurance engagements related to the liquidity of VBS? And I'm interested to know also who does within your unit quality control. And have you looked specifically into the debtor's book? Because compliance monitoring can only sometimes relate to the reports that they've submitted, but not specifically to look at the liquidity of an institution. And I also, because when we come to suggestions, I will be interested to look at the fine model. In the Wells Fargo case, if you can help us with the percentage terms of the fines that were preferred on the Wells Fargo company. Now, when it relates to VBS, Kuben, you see, I understand when you say you have been saying that VBS must acquire a commercial license, but you only specifically related to issues of supervision, you see. And to me, it shouldn't be limited to, it follows to what Floyd might have not said but wanted to say, that in terms of development, should people who acquire commercial licenses for banks not be looked at carefully and help to understand how the institutions should run? Because you see, here you identified a potential risk. I'm not sure whether you've got the latitude to only identify potential risks, or do you also provide solutions on what type of depositors when people want to be commercial banks can focus on, you see? Because here was a clear mistake that a municipal account supposed to be short-term. In this context, they provided long-term loans. Therefore, it was a risk to its liquidity. So in terms of governance, they might have not seen it coming, because maybe they might have had gentlemen agreements that at some point there'll be certain, for argument's sake, conditional grants that might be deposited into their bank to sustain their liquidity. And perhaps in this context, and I'm not saying you should be giving us those management information that relates to what was their perceptions in relation to how were they going to remain liquid. But it should have been a perception that they will hold specific accounts that can sustain them in the long term and both the short term. But if there's an element of a conflict of interest of an individual who runs a specific company but does not use the same institution as its depositor, then it makes one to have suspicions of the intentions of such individuals as to the aim not to sabotage the bank, not to be profitable or to sustain itself so that it takes bad management decisions. And South Africa has got a problem of that. Got a problem of people who serve either in boards who give very bad advice in terms of investment decisions that has been made. SAA is a typical example of that in terms of strategies against competitors. Because if you look at those individuals who hold key technical positions, they might have all shared information with competitors. And I'm not implying in this context that it has happened or it's happening. So Capitec might be a candidate of a campaign to liquidate it for a certain safety to remain a mayor safety in the South African context, especially those that are about to leave the shores of South Africa. It's untested, but it's possible. So I will not take the shortcut without probing deeper. At some point, you might want to take us into confidence on this matter, if that research has been conducted, that will help us beyond this point. But Chair, let me leave it at those. But one last question, because you see, when an institution comes and makes an allegation that is unfounded, you don't leave it as that. In terms of marketing purposes, you deal with it. because it's got a bearing on your performance. So if it's going to be found that the allegations made by Viceroy are not substantive, there might be some action that you'll want to take to maintain the integrity. You see, as we speak, Steinhoff is not going to trade. The African party don't want to trade in that name, given the impact of what has happened by the European unit on it. And I'm not saying anything, just throwing these things so that we can all think together on how we... And it will be a sad day if VBS, as a mutual bank, can be liquidated to a point where it can resuscitate itself or take advice to operate as a commercial bank, Floyd. if you understand. But the role of having to be able to be competitive, it's a role that all of us might want to think about, because setting regulations only and only looking at regulations and not providing difficult solutions. And remember, I raise this matter on a regular basis, that we might want to reconsider some of the mandates we carry that limits us to deal with the developmental agenda that we want to set moving forward. Thank you.
Mr. Lees was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then Mkuleko, you were after that, and then thank you, right? Oh, I forgot Gwen, yes, of course. And Gwen, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, if I can please start with VBS, Cuban. Jeez, you're very fortunate.
Sorry, you are making my job. You what you want?
I was about to report you to the ethics committee. I think it was good. Kuben, is that better? You know, you can call me anything you like as long as it's not late for dinner. The municipalities amount invested with the bank about the time of the curatorship was about 1.6 billion. So the curator was put in place, and you've said that there were limits put on withdrawal. I hear a figure of R1,000, and my question is, it's one thing for the small depositors to have R1,000 limit put on them, which in itself it has its own problems. But what is the impact on the 16 municipalities who had invested that 1.6 billion rand in terms of their own cash flows and the impact on service delivery? Are there different limits, and how is the curator going to deal with that? Do we anticipate a loan from the state to try and help the cash flow there? When you talk about the assets to liquidate, what kind of assets are there that may be able to liquidate in the short term, or even in the long term for that matter? At the time of the Sunday decision, PIC and Bella said, we don't have the money by Monday, you said. Are they coming to the party after the Monday? And if so, when and how? Now, Momo, you kind of commented, and I absolutely agree with you. Now, why should there be confidentiality about public entities' investment? So I'm taking it then. Well, let me put the question. Which are the municipalities, and how much have they got invested? And take into account Momo's very correct remark about the no need for confidentiality with public entities. So that deals with you and VBS. With regard to Capitec, I am a bit surprised that so much of the presentation dealt with the history of the bank, an attempt to discredit Viceroy, and not much time spent on the substantive issues. And I know that you're saying that the full report is available on the website, but Mr. Chairman, if it could be sent to us, I think that would be very helpful. But so let's just look at some of the issues, and they may well be dealt with in the full report. But so be it. I think it's pertinent that we raise some of these here. Now, based on your 2017 financial statements, your company generated 16 billion rand in fees not associated with transaction costs. So in other words, not your bank charges for a payment, a cash payment, or a check payment. So as a bank, you generated those 16 billion rand, which amounted to 35% of the loan book of 45 billion. So in other words, there's kind of very, very simplistically looking at it, you generated profits of 36% on the 45 billion rand loan book in 2017. Now, there's been comments about how that's done with possibly multiple origination fees and so on. It just seems like a hugely disproportionate profit to be making on that loan book. And given that you yourself have said the 9.2 million clients of your bank, isn't that really putting huge risk on those and potential delinquency? That's the first question, Mr. Chairman. Now, there has been talk about the multi-links loan and the court cases, and the one case you said was due this week, but it's been postponed indefinitely. Have you made an attempt to settle out of court on those cases? And what is the potential? And maybe Saab can assist here for a class action on that to develop and the potential liability that would come out of such an action. And then you've given quite an informative picture of the unsecured lending. But what is the extent, and forgive me if I've missed this, what is the extent of the cured or the giving loans to repay old loans? What is the actual extent of that in numbers, not in rand? How many of those, let's give perhaps in the 2017 year. Now, Capitec, I understand, is part of Bursa, and there was an agreement reached with National Treasury and Bursa that there would not be the use of garnishee orders to recover defaulting clients. There's a media statement, I have it here if you wish to read it, issued and signed by Sim Shabalala, I think, on behalf of Bursa. I take it that you're shaking your head indicates that you're not aware of this and that you do continue to use garnishee orders. You can confirm that in due course. The other thing coming out of that particular statement is the debit order runs. Now, there's an allegation that if there's a client who owes money and you've got a debit order, but perhaps there are other debit orders, so what you do is you run the debit order run the day before the salary gets paid into the bank account. The bank account goes into overdraft, and then your debit order is prioritized when the salary is paid in the next day. What is there any element of truth in that? And Our understanding is that you use CompuScan to do credit checks. Mr. Chairman, that's my information. What proportion of your credit checks is handled by CompuScan? Is it greater than 50% of your credit checks? Mr. Chairman, my last question deals with the audit fees. Now, Capitec have told us that they're the biggest, they have the most more clients than any other bank, and they have 9.2 million clients, customers. How is it possible that your audit fees run at about 4 million rand a year versus the other mainline banks that run 100 and more million rand a year? Does that indicate a lack of due diligence in the audits? And why do you only appoint one auditor and not two auditors, as the other banks do? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You'll excuse me if I'm asking a question that perhaps you know, has been dealt with in previous sessions. This is my first sitting in this committee, but I did want to raise how seriously I think there needs to be a separation between the matters for which Capitec might need to answer for and to the extent there might be wrongdoing on Viceroy's part. I think even though you know, there might be wrongdoing on Viceroy's part, you know, that's a separate matter from whether there aren't any serious matters, as my colleague has raised, for Capitec to answer to. And in terms of that, I just found the presentation by Treasury and I suppose also by the FSB not quite clear as to whether there is clarity around the possible charges, you know, especially as it relates to the prohibited trading practices. There doesn't seem to be clarity as to whether it was instances of insider trading or perhaps what exactly are those prohibited practices that they're specifically investigating. Because it seems to me there seems to be a clearer case for perhaps the short and distort strategy that has been implemented here. I mean, all the classic sort of tick boxes for that strategy seem to be present. And while short selling is a perfectly legal activity, it seems here that there are established claims both from the Treasury and the Registrar who've confirmed that, I mean, I suppose, and from Capitec's report as well, that there are factual claims in the Viceroy reports that are, I think everyone is in agreement about, that they are false. And if that is the case, and that seems to be almost a clear-cut short and distort strategy where you're not just short-selling, but the intention is to then thereafter purposely spread negative and false information in order to purposely drive the price down. And I'm just wondering why there doesn't seem to be enough evidence to suggest or to pursue that particular case at this point in time. What is missing from a classical short and distort strategy that we feel requires further investigation when there seems to be when both sides seem to be of common mind, that there are clear falsehoods in that Viceroy report. And then the second point to make is that despite there being legitimate evidence for or legitimate suspicion that there is a case of wrongdoing on the part of Viceroy, so that I think there is, other than wanting to be punitive and to punish Viceroy for spreading false information, I think there's a very important domestic case to be made about why it's important to pursue legal action. And that's the fact that, well, when we talk about banks, we often talk about maybe systemic risk in a capital liquidity sense. But I think there's a very real risk here of almost systemic reputational risk. And we've seen it already in terms of how often Steinhoff is raised in this matter dealing with Capitec. It's a completely unrelated, unrelated case, but the similarities are being brought into this case, which shows just how events such as these can cause systemic reputational risk, where the incidences of wrongdoing in one business suddenly are extrapolated to businesses across the market, and not just to our listed companies, but also to the efficacy or the ability of the regulators to ensure that there are no market distortions. So I think if there is indeed wrongdoing, I think it's important to take it up because there might be very serious dangers of systemic reputational crisis in the South African market where a report such as this in future, whether it's by Viceroy or any other firm, lands or gains that much more traction because it's already believed that there's a lack of credibility in the way that South African businesses or banks behave, or that there's a lack of authority or regulatory oversight in the way that our regulators behave. And I think we need to be quite aware of that systemic reputational risk and how to contain it going forward. And I think an important measure of that containment would be to decisively act against those who perhaps spread falsehoods.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to try to be as brief as possible.
Took up close to 35 minutes on the media statement on the SARS Commissioner matter and the fact that I had to, if you like, respond today on matters that arose at the end of last week Tuesday's meeting in terms of the rules of Parliament. So I did say, I'm told that because Thabo has done correct, he acted in terms of the rules, the policies don't allow us to have lunch if we don't sit for the whole day. And once Parliament cancelled that this morning, you'll have to run for your lunch. I don't know where you'll get it.
Then you will have to make us leave at the first one, please.
No, we're pleading with people. It's in exceptional circumstances. We will prefer to die in the struggle, not to leave you, Tandi. You can sacrifice a bit. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. I think we must drive home the point that a whistleblower, by nature, is probably not going to enjoy the support of those with whom he's speaking against. And so whether one likes Viceroy or not, I think it does no justice to try and demonize Viceroy without interrogating the content of what Viceroy is saying. And so I think we must interrogate further the content of what they said. Of course, there are other ways and means to look at the characters behind it. But really, I think at the center of this is I don't get a sense that whatever Viceroy had said is being treated with the seriousness which we could probably want to ascribe to it. There's a movement to say, no, Viceroy, no, just don't bother with these people. And that, for me, presents a very, very big problem. So I think, Chair, that did not do justice at all. Secondly, Chair, I heard the NCR saying, well, VBS is a small bank in a rural, kitchen for rural people. It sounded very dismissive. And I just was quite uneasy about that. And why I raised it, what I want to raise is, to what extent were the affected rural communities, and I speak with a bias because I'm a rural boy myself, were they consulted to explain the realities which were before the bank, before such a major decision was taken? Because I would imagine that, so now a statement has gone out from the chair of the board to say, right, there's a problem, and so fire. Okay, fair enough, let's assume that's the case. But did the core client base of VBS understand that dilemma, and was it communicated to them, or they were just slapped with the curatorship and they must now try and navigate circumstances and conditions which are not of their own doing? I'm interested to understand the community stakeholder engagement in that regard, to speak to the people who would have been directly affected, or was this a media statement made somewhere else and we forgot about the little guy, as tends to be the case in most cases. Chair, the main shareholders, they came to Reserve Bank and said, no, we are going to try and raise funds. And before, I suppose, they could come back and do that, the Reserve Bank engaged them, the PIC and Valet, right? I'm trying to then gauge the commitment of the PIC and Valet to the Reserve Bank and its own board. Here on one hand, I would imagine the board would have not made a commitment to say, come back to us on Monday, if there was no commitment of any sort to say, we'll try and raise funds. I want to understand what changed. what necessitated the Reserve Bank to sort of throw the javelin and leave the board behind and engage with PIC ahead of the board? Where did that arise from? Because it's, for me, it highlights the urgency of which curatorship was placed on the table, which is quickly, speedily, let's arrive at this thing before due process thoroughly was followed. And then, twofold. So, what's the status of the individuals who consisted and comprised of this board? Because I would imagine if you, and I use the term lightly and I use it in jest, if you're going to tank a bank, collapse it in one way or the other, surely there must be consequences. Now, that's what I want to understand. Because the aggrieved response of the board and board members, for me, is an indication of what there isn't a full appreciation of just the realities of the, like, no, there's a different view. So are these persons now going to be classified as delinquent directors? What happens? What's their status? What's their recourse? I think we should be fine, but maybe down the line, the manner in which this entire process could have been differently. And so maybe, Chair, that on its own emphasizes the point why we need to engage with those persons. I think we need to hear the other side. We have heard the official Reserve Bank sequence of events, but could be that there's possibly a different narrative which may emerge out of what the board members may say. So I'm interested for the committee rather to clear the air in that regard. Finally, Chair, insofar as Capitec is concerned, I want to be satisfied that this affirmation, which there's nothing wrong with Capitec processes, I think it needs to be tested. I think a loan on top of a loan is most certainly, as far as I see it, particularly because we know what Capitec caters for, which constituency, for which people. Now, are we not opening up an avalanche? Would we want the crisis to first happen before we respond? Prevention, as far as I'm concerned, is better than cure. And I would implore on the Reserve Bank, the NCR, and Treasury to relook at this model, this practice, whether it does not lead our people down the slippery slope of debt, whilst on the other hand propping up the books and the image of Capitec. Let us find a fair balance, but it certainly does not augur well in the manner in which it has been presented. So I just want to confine myself to that. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Koleko. Peggy?
Thanks, Chair. Chairperson, I just want to make a point here. It is a fact that out there are monopolies, there are duopolies, and there are oligopolies, whereby certain, you know, powerful role players would ensure that they try by all means to elbow out those who seem to be weaker than them. We really need to be vigilant. And when we talk about transformation, we need to emphasize on one point that even in the sector, the banking sector, we need to see transformation. You know, there are four powerful banks that have been acting in this space. And I think everybody was quite elated to see VBS in particular participating in this space, though it is still a mutual bank. But we would like to see VBS participating in that space of the commercial banks. So
I'm glad to hear that there is an intention of assisting VBS to move out of the situation in which they found themselves and be assisted, because they need to be assisted. If you want to see a real transformation, you need to hold that role player by hand and say, you do this, you do this, you fill in this form, you implement this, so that ultimately you do achieve what you envisage to achieve. So our plea to the role players, to the stakeholders here, is that please ensure that what we envisage to achieve is achieved. Thank you.
There were lots of questions, right? You can't answer them all. I just want some guidance from members. It's now 10 past. We owe this meeting 35 minutes, right? So the idea would be to finish at 14:05. Is that okay? Yes. I understand that, remember, we exempt. We're exempted by the Chief Whip, Cedric Frolic, Mr. Steenhuisen, and Mr. Shivambu, until the issue came that he told me that, hey, what are you going to call this? Commissioner fully suspended. It's hilarious, the exchange. All right, those who are asking questions, presumably you're not Dickie Lady spokesperson. She's going to ask the question. She can be excused. But you are the whip. You can excuse yourself and leave. But the committee goes on. I have no mandate to stop this meeting. So can we go on? Those who want to leave, Tandy, they'll answer to you. The meeting goes on till 14:05. Is there any in principle objection to that? The other option is to break at 13:30. And then where are they going to go and have lunch? Because there's no lunch arrangement, and rightly so, we thought we'd finish at 13:30. I'm supposed to be at a PBO board meeting for half an hour till 14:00. In any case, can I now say, let's continue. We cannot leave things hanging in the air. A lot of things have been said. It is unfair to people who are here not to be able to reply. For once, this committee is late. In fact, since 2014, I cannot remember a single situation, Tandy, since 2014 July, that we've sat through without a lunch agreement. I hope Tandy is listening. It has never happened in this committee before. It's unprecedented. I didn't ask for the president to suspend the commissioner last night on the eve of the meeting we're supposed to have at 2 o'clock. He didn't consult with me and said, Eunice, what will be the lunch arrangements? Because I'm a bit worried, you know. I'm worried now. Because then you'll have to issue a statement. And I know you had issues with the committee last week. I saw it on... By the way, he did ask me on TV. He saw me. He did ask me about last week's meeting, by the way. I had a fleeting exchange with him. He said, yeah, let's not cover that ground, right? I've reported to my own study group. There's no need for me. He was the president of the ANC when he was speaking to me then. Right. You have the right to reply. Tandy herself knows it. I will brief her. And then she'll forget next week that I briefed her, but I'll go and brief her. Tandy, I'm teasing you. Let's move on. Let's start with you, Capitec. You can give written replies as well. And we'll have to have a follow-up meeting, obviously. But you go for it first.
Thank you, Chairman. There's quite a lot of questions. I'm going to try and... I've dotted it down, so I'm going to try and... Okay, that's fine. If I first... one of the first allegations is that we're involved with Steinhoff. Viceroy also alleged that. We've made it clear in our response to Viceroy, and that's public information. It's on our sense that we've got no link to Steinhoff. PSG had Steinhoff had a 20% shareholding in PSG. PSG is our main shareholder with a 30% shareholding. Marcus Juster was 2 years on our board. I think it was 2011 and 2012. They bought JD Group, and we agreed mutually that there's a conflict of interest, and he resigned. But we've got no dealings with Steinhoff. We don't work with them. We're working completely independent. The question regarding the number of loans, if you go and look at our number of loans per client, it is averaging less than 1.5 loans per client. And if you go and look at what is happening in the industry, if you're sitting with a 6, 7, 8 year loan, in all probability you will have a facility or you will have a credit card. Majority of people has got more than two or three types of loans. What the NCR reflected on was 4 or 5 specific clients that had plus minus about 5 or 6 loans. For us, we investigated. They also reported that those clients was 100% compliance, and we brought in manual rules where a client can't have more than 4 loans. I just want to emphasize that is that if a client qualifies for, let's say, a 100,000 rand loan and he decides only to take 10,000, nothing stops him to actually come in later and then take another loan. And the moment you're stopping the number of loans, you're forcing that client actually to take the full 100,000 even if he's not going to use it. So members need to take that in consideration. But are we quite comfortable with our number of loans at less than 1.5 per client? If I look at the acquisitions on the multi-loan, where it's alleged that the client can just go onto the app or on the ATM and get the loan, that is not true. There's numerous steps. There's 7 steps that's been performed by ourselves to make certain that the person can afford it and his credit checks has been done. All of that is in our court papers. We've published the court papers done by Summit. That is what Viceroy has published. We've published our opposing papers to clearly indicate the way we do affordability and the way we go about it. So that is available, the full court papers on that, to see both sides of the story. There was a question on high return, and that's why Viceroy has attacked us. I want to emphasize, if you go and look at our increase in income on credit for the last couple of years, it's been in single-digit figures, and the majority of our growth is actually coming in out of our transactional side, and the transactional side is actually done with our very strong growth that we're getting out of our client base. Our client base is increasing with plus minus 1 million clients per year. So our transactional income has grown over 30% year on year. And I think it's a reflection where the economy puts pressure on clients and then clients are looking for value for money. And we've grown tremendously in that side. 42% of our income is now coming from transactional income. So it's a well-balanced portfolio. I just want to emphasize, if I look at the affordability guidelines by the National Credit Act, on average, we're about between 20 and 30% stricter than what is prescribed by the National Credit Act. And where we, our staff make a mistake and we pick up an error, we write off immediately. Because for us, it's 100%, or it's very important to be 100% compliant. If I look at the question on what portion of our income is fee income and what portion of our income is loan origination and interest, if I look at our fees for 2017, 12.4 billion was interest, initiation was 0.8, monthly 0.8, so a very small portion of our income is actually coming from monthly fees and initiation fees. There was a question on, did we try and settle out of court with Summit? Yes, on 2 occasions we tried to settle out of court, but we didn't get to agreement and we decided to go to court. And like I've mentioned, the Fransal case took place in Stellenbosch Court last week. The case has been asked on it, to be postponed, so one will have to see what's coming out. The second case, Tobiani, will be heard in May at High Court, and one will have to see what comes out of that. Is there possible class action on it? We don't believe there is. We're quite confident with the multi-loan product because that's what it's all about. The National Credit Regulators has gone through the product. They've accepted the product. They're happy with what we're doing, so we don't believe there's any risk on that. I did mention that if you look at the rolling of loans or what Viceroy alleged, that 20% of our loans is consolidated, and that is where a person takes out, let's say, a loan today, and 3 or 4 years from now, he wants another loan. What we will do is we'll consolidate his existing loan and then give him a new loan, but based on a new affordability, new credit information, making certain that he's 100% compliant. There's about 14% of our clients that make use of that, so it's a very small portion of it. There was also a question to say, do we, and I know Viceroy has asked that, is there certain of our clients that is in arrears and then we immediately we borrow to them, distressed clients. We've gone through that in detail and it's 0.8 0.06% of our clients that fits in that barrier. And I've personally investigated every single client in the last 3 months to make certain that our credit models are working, and I'm quite comfortable with the circumstances of those clients that we 100% correct. If I look at garnishing orders is still a legal way of collecting. We try and avoid it as far as possible, but the client has got an obligation that he owes us something. So in very utmost instances, we will make use of garnishing orders, and we make 100% certain that we audit our EDCs on a regular basis, quarterly, to make certain that they comply 100% according to the legal norms. If I look at NADO, do we get preferential treatment? No. Whenever we submit a payment or installment, it goes into a random, so we've got no control. It is controlled by Barza, and it's on a random basis. So there's no way we can manipulate or make certain that we get preferential treatment on it. Then if I look at CompuScan, the question was asked, who's our bearer? Who's the bearer that we're using? It's CompuScan, and they do 100% of our credit bureaus, and then we use TransUnion in other specific cases wherever we need other additional information. The question of the audit fee compared to other banks, should we have one auditor or two auditors? I think if you do that comparison, you need to do a thorough comparison to understand we are monoline business, only retail. The other banks are sitting with merchant banking, they're sitting with investment banking, they're sitting with treasury, they're sitting with a far more complex environment than ourselves. They're also sitting with a lot of their assets or operations overseas in Africa or the rest of other countries. So it's very difficult to compare ourselves to other banks' audit fees, because you can't compare, you need to compare apples with apples. And that's also one of the reasons we've only got one auditor, because we've only got a retail business and we operate in a retail environment. Then a question that was asked, are we serious about Viceroy? Did we investigate all the investigations? Personally, myself and Andre Duplessis sitting next to me, plus about a team of about 20 to 30 people, was pulled off for the last basically 2 months, and every single allegation was investigated and evaluated to ensure that we are compliant and that we are doing it correctly. And that's why if I go and look at the Viceroy reports, they probably has published in probably about 40...
You're about 10 minutes. I'll give you a minute more and then...
Yeah,
if you give written replies, we'll distribute.
They've published about in the region of about 40 reports. On every single acquisition they've made, we've given a comprehensive report that is published on Sense and that is available. The question was asked, should we can send it, it's available. We'll make certain that all the committee members get the full report. But we take the Viceroy reports very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Saab? Okay, whatever. I think don't take up to 10 minutes if you have to.
No, Chair, I think, let me start so that then the regulators can deal with the specific areas that they deal with. I think, just to start off, I think certainly for members, I think members have asked important questions, and I think we've come many times to Parliament to say that we are concerned about some of the lending practices of many institutions in South Africa. I don't believe that we are tough enough, despite provisions on reckless lending. I think that there needs to be a much more intrusive approach. And if you look at Twin Peaks, that only takes effect hopefully some on or soon after 1st April. It's going to take a bit of a while to get the market conduct regulator. I think also just looking more broadly on the attempts to deal with over-indebtedness. We've been working closely with the Department of Trade and Industry. There's initiatives in this direction. I think we need to move much faster and harder to resolve issues in this respect. So, Chair, I want to be very clear. As Treasury or as regulators, we're not here to defend or Capitec or Viceroy. Okay. We're not saying Capitec is innocent of this or that transgression. The issue is, when is information that's out in the public domain, I hope the regulators are doing their work and looking at these issues. There are important reports like the summit report, which I think need to be looked at and dealt with. And I suspect this is not just an issue with Capitec, but generally there's still issues like those that need to be looked at. I think in all these instances, Chair, and I'm thinking of a way forward, I think it's very hard for the regulators to come and say someone is innocent. To the extent that they're investigating, they could say what they're investigating, but perhaps where such issues come up, it may be that Parliament requests a formal report, let's say on lending practices and abuses, and let's have a session on that. Give them the task to come up with a report, because I think it is an important area. Because I think the problem, as I said, may not be specific to one bank, or it may be specific to one bank. Let them come and make relevant comments in that. I think with the issue of Viceroy, we want to point out that this is not an issue of a whistleblower. In their own report, they say they use public information. So it's not new information specifically. There's been court cases going around, and yes, they've brought things together with a particular perspective, but it is out there, and I think it's legitimate to see on all of these instances what should be taken further and what not. But having said that, there's always many reports. I think the registrar has said how many analyst reports you have. It's also not feasible, I think, for us to look at every analyst report, because remember, ultimately what they're saying is buy that share or sell that share. That's what they're trying to do. And they too, I think, just need to be regulated. You need walls when it comes to advisors. And I was just trying to point out that this institution is not regulated. It's got a clear financial interest in this matter that needs to be taken into account. I did say how they release the information is problematic. But that doesn't mean that what's been said should be ignored. So let me be clear. We are saying any information. In fact, we want regulators to be hungry and curious and reading all over the place, because you often find the real facts by just reading around and asking lots and lots of questions. Chair, with regard to BBS, I think we were asked on specific issues like the number of municipalities. Let me say something which I omitted saying. The reality now, and the registrar can confirm the figure, but there's about R1 billion that municipalities who invested at the moment is not available to them. And there's no guarantee, and because their deposits are not guaranteed, they stand to lose that amount if the funds are not to be found. I think it's a bit early for us to reveal the names of all those, and we would like to do it, because part of it is we ourselves didn't know which specific municipalities. And I think, Chair, it needs to be remembered, perhaps there was a culture before the big change this year that certain people couldn't be touched because they were politically connected. Those who break the law don't come and volunteer and say to TV Palay, we bank here. This was not their primary municipal account. It was their secondary account. TV Palay sits in the treasury and monitors the primary bank accounts and where government makes payments. We can give you a breakdown by province of the municipalities. I'll ask, do you want to just read what the amounts are? And the info we have at this stage, we want to give you the info once we've confirmed. What we've been doing is, on the one hand, you check with the registrar. On the other hand, we check with the municipalities. Is it the case that you have this amount of money? And let me say, whilst we're trying to get information on when did they withdraw and so on, we're quite happy as Treasury that the curator can give an objective report to provide actual dates. These things, these need to be confirmed. You can't take what one party tells us. That's why I'm reluctant just to put it out there, because we're dependent on what the quality of information that's been given to us. But do you want to just give that breakdown?
Sure.
TV, you should be, it's your figures, but anyway.
With all the caveats that Momo has just outlined, in Gauteng province there are two municipalities whose exposures largely relate to conditional grants. That exposure is currently around 130 million rands. In Limpopo province, there are nine municipalities. Their exposures largely relate to the equitable share. Their current exposures are around 1.12 billion rands. Mpumalanga province has had one municipality. They have now withdrawn their deposit, so they currently have no exposure. And the final province that has exposures, the Northwest province, where four municipalities have exposures, and these exposures also largely relate to the conditional grants that they receive, and their exposures are about 313 million rands.
So, Chair, if you look at those figures, and let me say, for us as a Treasury, we're worried. Most of those municipalities are not your big and rich municipalities that have their own revenue. These are municipalities that have hardly any revenue, and they seem to have put their funds here, and now these funds, even if they ultimately become available, may not be available until things are sorted out. That is going to affect service delivery. So when we accuse that there's a, you know, you're getting municipalities to take your money out or so, the problem for us is some of those depositors are state institutions. And at the end of the day, it's going to come back on the fiscus, because when they don't deliver, people are going to say, government must find a way of finding the money, bring those to account, etc. So I think that that's just with regard to municipalities. The registrar can just confirm the big figures, but you can see the figures total over a billion rands, and they are, sorry, 1.5 billion rands. Okay, so that's the worry we have from the Treasury's perspective. I think, Chair, just on these issues,
8.5, right?
Sorry?
8.5 minutes. We're going to have a follow-up meeting. I just want some guidance from the committee, right? I'm cool. I can stay until 3, 4, whatever. What does the committee want to do? Do you want to stick to 10 minutes per stakeholder? Do you want to expand it or what?
Chair, we also want you in the house for various reasons.
Okay, so is that the majority view? Okay, what's the majority view? Tandy, you're a chief whip of our party. You speak for yourself in this context.
She spoke on behalf
of the party. Okay, take a lady also.
Please, Chair.
Yeah, okay. So what do other parties feel? It's interesting, it's 3 versus 3, eh?
No, Chair, I think we can adjourn the meeting so that we prepare for the question session later on, Deputy President. But I think we must make follow-up on Capitec's conduct issues. And if...
The end, right?
Yeah.
The end,
if Viceroy is something wrong, let us then get the summit, the submissions on...
Fine. Okay,
conduct,
we'll look into that, but right now...
We cannot allow these
institutions
to abuse
now, people. We're sitting till 14:05. Let's do that. You got one more minute.
Okay, Chair. So I think what we've asked, obviously, the regulators, and certainly with VBS, that there will be proper reports that come out. Obviously, even before the final report, sometimes there are interim reports, so that they come out, because certainly for the public and for the depositors, they need to know what's happening, whether they're going to be paid out, over and above the 50,000 guarantee. And I think we are most concerned in particular for those widows and orphans and what's going to happen. Will they be able to make their monthly payments? That's something we've asked the regulator to look into. As I said, the FSB can come with the exact figure, but I think we are looking at 378 million rands. And obviously, once those reports are here, I think we can see who's responsible for what. Is it the Treasury that, you know, sparked, triggered this? We're quite happy to allow that process to determine the facts.
Okay, Reserve Bank, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll largely deal with the VBS issues. There were one or two Capitec issues, but I think they've largely been dealt with. Chair, on the design of the curatorship, why for African Bank we had a effectively got other banks to put money in and we haven't here. I'm pretty sure that before the end of the process there will be a call for public funds to be put in here. However, it is true that as we have gone in to do the curatorship, we are finding out things that we didn't know that existed before that. That's the nature of the curatorship, right? It is not true that we have no plan to protect the depositors. Capitec has about 390 million rands of what I would call retail depositors. They're either individuals or stock fells or funeral societies or clubs or associations. We will apply a look-through principle. So if there are 100 people in the stock fell and the stock fell has 100,000, each of those 100 people will protect 50,000 rand of those deposits. We believe through that 99.8% of the depositors will be protected. It is true that there is hardship caused because there's a lack of liquidity. We're working flat out to try and resolve those issues. Within the next few days, we are making progress every day and we're increasing those limits every day. We have a commitment from the curator that when there are new deposits for salaries, people can withdraw those monies. We just have to figure out the system configuration to do that. On the timing of the curatorship, that meeting on Thursday that we had before the curatorship, when the bank said that they will get money in by Monday morning, they effectively said that they will get money from the PIC. I went directly to the PIC because after the letter was issued on the Friday night, it was quite clear that there was a risk of the run. I asked the PIC, has your investment committee decided to put X amount of money into the bank? And the PIC said, no, our investment committee has not decided to put that money into the bank. It was absolutely clear that we had no choice to put the bank under curatorship. Chair, when you put banks under curatorship, sometimes you are criticized for acting too early, in which case you could damage shareholder interest, and sometimes you are criticized for acting too late because you could be criticized for damaging depositor interest. There's always that trade-off. In this particular case, I think we went out of our way to try and support the bank over a long period of time. I think we went out of our way to try and encourage the growth of the bank, to work with the bank to remedy the issues. But at the end of the day, supervision is not running a bank. At the end of the day, the board and the management have to be held accountable. And I am pretty sure that there will be a commission of inquiry, there will be a forensic investigation into this bank, and if there is any fraud that is uncovered, if there is any malfeasance that is uncovered, I'm pretty sure we will deal with that. I'm proud to say that after 11 years after the curatorship of Regal Bank, we got a conviction. Mr. Levenstein was convicted, he went to jail. And if there is fraud in this case, if a commission of inquiry finds that there was malfeasance, we will follow every step of the legal process, no matter how long it takes, to ensure that there are consequences for people who defraud the public. Chair, I want to make two more quick points. The one is that we fully agree that transformation of the banking system is critical. We have to transform the banking system in two dimensions. The first dimension is that we do have to disrupt the position and the influence of the big four banks. We have to do that by licensing newer banks, by using technology plays to try and establish niche players in the financial sector, by broadening the ambit of financial services that are offered. But there has to be a degree of disruption of the financial sector. The second degree of transformation has to be to get the racial transformation of the financial sector. We are committed to that. But at the same time, we've got a responsibility towards depositors. We cannot have a situation where we say, well, that's a black bank. It's okay if there are problems. If we do that, black people won't have trust in those banks and won't put money in. So we have to supervise those banks as carefully and as closely as we would supervise any other institution, notwithstanding a commitment to transformation. Chair, the last point I want to make is a point that Mr. Shivambu started off on. I do think that there is a need for a discussion with this committee about the role of the banks in the unsecured lending market in general. And let me give you both sides of the argument. The one side of the argument is, while you're lending to people at 32% interest plus insurance plus, this is exploitative. Right? The other side of the argument is that if the banks don't do it, people will go to unregulated microlenders and the machonisas, where the interest rates are even higher and the collection practices are even more egregious. I do think that South Africa has a problem. We have an indebtedness problem in the middle classes and the lower middle classes problem. I don't think the solution is to simply stop the banks from lending in the unsecured market. Yes, as Momo said, there has to be clear standards, there has to be clear conduct rules that we must not compromise on. But there does need to be a broader discussion about how we are able to get households out of this overly indebtedness. Chair, I think I've covered most of the questions that have been asked. Let me leave it there. Sorry, last question point, Chair. We have been engaging with the communities, both through the curator on Venda language radio stations, through the representatives of the King in the area. We have attempted, with fairly limited duration and limited resources, to try and communicate as clearly as possible what curatorship means and how it will impact on people. This is a changing process, and I think we're making progress day by day. Thanks.
Okay, FSB. Oh, NCR, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the reckless lending provision, which is Section 80, that was referred to, normally what we do when we conduct reckless lending investigations is that we would ask for evidence from a complainant, and we work from there. But in the case of Capitec, because it was a compliance check, we obviously looked at a sample of credit agreements. And in terms of those credit agreements that we assessed, there was no reckless lending that was detected. I'd also like to respond to Honorable Tobias's questions around the assurance engagement reports. The assurance engagement reports are submitted by auditors annually, and they only look at compliance with the National Credit Act. They don't look at issues of liquidity. And in terms of the quality control, the compliance manager is the one who runs with this, but it's finally reviewed by management and executive. The fines that were imposed on Wells Fargo were in the range of $185 million. Thank you.
FSB.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, our investigation into this Capitec matter involves to try and establish whether there's contravention of the Financial Markets Act in three specific areas. One, whether there was insider trading. Secondly, whether there was any prohibitive trading practices. And thirdly, whether there was false or misleading information or reporting. The example the Honorable Member gave of shorting and distorting is an American description, and it covers both in our law prohibitive trading practices as well as false and misleading information we put into the system. So that's what our investigative process is trying to uncover. Thank you, Chair.
Who's left? That's it. Is that right? Oh, we finished before two. The question I want to raise now is, I think we shouldn't take any decisions right now. I just want members to think about this, right? Finally, it's your call. The first is, I don't think we should come to any conclusions. This is our initial foray, and we have to give people a chance, both on the side of the members of parliament, to internalize what's been said, and the regulators and treasury and other statutory bodies to do their work. So there has to be a follow-up meeting. The second thing is, I think that we should be very, very clear to everybody here who's been making presentations that we are very, very concerned about VBS. We understand all the complexities you've referred to. We understand, too, that you have to protect the depositors. In our own financial sector transformation report and other reports made it clear, we have to find the right balances. I think, I can't recall how we put it. We said, yes, we must create a space for African emerging entrepreneurs to grow and grow in the financial sector. It's long overdue. But it cannot be at the expense of African poor and disadvantaged and lower income depositors. The right balance is found. So people, we also said, mustn't use as an excuse. The state institutions often use as an excuse that they are protecting the depositors to rationalize the failure to transform. But on the other hand, we're not populist. Most of us in this committee, at least the ANC's position, is that we have to also protect the very constituents that we ourselves as ANC and other parties claim to be representing. So the right balance has to be found. So I think really that is our main concern right now, I would imagine. We cannot allow VBS not to be rescued, but where VBS officials or shareholders or boards or whatever have done wrong, they must actually face the music like everybody else, never mind the skin color. Okay? The next thing is on Capitec. I'm asking members to think very carefully about what we're doing here. Because some of the practices that Capitec is accused of is probably also being committed by the other banks. We had a major, major public hearing on the financial sector transformation. And while I was sitting with you, I got an invitation by NEDLAC. They've now postponed the summit, the financial sector summit, from the 5th and 6th to later in the month. Last week, I got an invitation from another bank to come and speak. I must tell you, repeatedly we're getting invitations, right, to take them through our report. So that report is being taken seriously. Now, some of these issues are in the report anyway, colleagues. Our aim is to actually ensure the government brings policies and legislation to this committee to process. Our aim is to hold the regulators to account. Now, if we're going to call Capitec and cross-examine them, then we must call all the other banks too. Think about that, because it's not fair, right? It's not fair. So I don't think the committee can conclude anything at this stage about Capitec. But I agree with members who say, never mind how bad or good Viceroy is, and even if they're very bad, we must look, as everybody said, and as a chair at one stage I meant to intervene, but because of time constraints I didn't. Look, never mind how bad Capitec is, deal with their issues. So Viceroy is. Now, may I put it to you, Capitec? It's in your own interest to, if you can, in the public domain, I think it's there. Give us your whole report. We have a brilliant researcher and an outstanding committee, the content advisor, vice versa. They're both brilliant, right? They will spend our constituency, if Peter is not here, to summarize what you're saying. If we call back this number, this meeting again, we have to be very clear that we're starting from where we left off. And what exactly are we seeking to do? And I would urge that we don't rush headlong into it. I'm also worried that we're finishing at the end of May. And let me remind members, we've got a carbon tax bill, the VAT bill, as I call it, the two tax bills that are coming. There's also the PIC bill. Now, the Postbank bill is coming both from you, and I read in the Sunday papers from AFF as well. Right? We've told you, Momo, and your ministers, we're tired now, you have endless ministers, right? Please, let's hope it stops here for now. The thing is, we've told all your ministers, give us a standalone bill so we can process Postbank. The ANC study group is meeting next week to decide. I can tell you what we're already speaking about. We do not have the capacity to bring any more bills this year. Get real. You can table them, but we ain't going to sit here on Fridays. And myself, 9 hours on Saturday. Alan, I spoke to Alan. Five hours on Sunday. I have another political life. This is just a deployment. I'm elected in the other structure. I'm answerable to 3,000 people, 2,500 people. I have a deployment. Tomorrow I can, I'm gone to Mongolia or wherever. So can I say to you, Momo, get real. You've worked outstandingly, but on my side, I'm telling you from the ANC side, I'm going to look for a mandate next week, right? So what I'm saying, colleagues, is can we avoid any sweeping statements on all sides? I think both the MPs were correct in many of the things, in my view, they said. And you were also correct in many of the things you said. We're looking from different vantage points. Then finally, on our FST report, now on this very Friday, I explained I've got an SACP meeting. It's a standard meeting. The ANC exempts me on
third or fourth Friday of every month. Tandy was supposed to chair. I've got three requests now that we don't meet on Friday, including astonishingly from the DA, right? So what I'm saying is this Friday is off unless we can produce at least four members. We've got the Financial Sector Transformation Report, the FSR regulations, and the PIC bill. But I gather David Mania, who's the main person for Friday morning, won't be here anyway because they've got a baby in their family. So can I take it we can call off Friday morning? Plenaries have been called off, I'm told. Ask Floyd about that. They did take these decisions. So it's only committees on Thursday and Friday. So can I thank you all? No final conclusions are being made. It's an initial foray, and Capitec will be treated no differently from any of its competitors. That's how we're going to proceed. Thank you very much.
Usually these guys, they know us, and there's rapport, you know, that natural rapport, right?
Oh, good.
Yeah, so, it's, yeah.